We're going to call this committee meeting to order. This is the Friday, April 5th, 2013 meeting of the Transportation and Public Safety Finance Division. Welcome, everyone. Members, just to let everyone know, a couple of things are going on. So the table is probably going to look a little sparse for much of this hearing. I apologize, but, you know, we're bearing down on deadlines. So we've got members who are scattered throughout the building. I'm not even completely confident that we're going to achieve a quorum today. So we've got folks who are also back in their districts. But that's not super important. It's just very, very important for us to hear the governor's bill and the change items that have come in the supplemental budget, as well as hearing the vision that's been put forth by Progress in Motion in our transportation stakeholders from throughout the state in Senate File 891. So we have the opportunity to hear those ideas and opportunities. And then our plan is to not take action on either of these bills, but to lay them on the table. And then, of course, everyone knows that we're going to be hearing a number of bills on Monday, and we're going to be rolling out the committee bill, the finance package on Monday. We'll lay that on the table for the time being. And then on Wednesday, we'll take that up for markup and committee action on our way to Finance Committee. With that, we will start with Senate File 694, the Governor's Transportation Finance Bill, and then we'll hear subsequent to that the public safety portions. And the plan is we'll just have the agencies come forward, present from the table. I'll just stay here at the chair's seat while we hear those pieces, and then I'll go out to the table to help present Senate File 891. So with that, I invite MnDOT and or Met Council forward to present. There we are. Senate File 694. Welcome, Mr. Peterson, Chair Haig, Mr. Shetnin.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. How would you like to proceed?
We have to delete all the A1 amendment to work off of. We're not really able to take action on it, but we'll just put that in front of the committee. So, members, you have the A1 delete all amendment in your packets. Great. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, you want us to walk through each of the appropriations or just the change items, or what's your preference?
Why don't we walk through the whole bill, because it's been a while since we've been acquainted with the governor's bill, and just highlight which are our changes in the supplemental. Well, you know, which are the change items, and then which are then different from the first bill's introduction in the supplemental.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Peterson from the Department of Transportation, and I'll just start with the Department of Transportation section, which is at the beginning of the bill, starting first with our multimodal systems appropriations and our aeronautics. In our aeronautics appropriation, we have a couple things going on. Our airport development and assistance, we're requesting a reduction of $650,000 per year in that appropriation. The original governor's recommendation was $500,000 per year, and the supplemental budget recommendations in asked for a $650,000 reduction, and that is to better align the spending from the fund with our expected revenue. Because of the bankruptcy of a couple of regional carriers, we expect our revenues to be lower in the coming years. And the aviation support and services, we've got a change of $263,000, I believe it is, in the trunk highway portion of the appropriations for aviation support and services, and that reflects what we have done in the past is transferred money from our other appropriations to the department under our existing authority to fund some of that service, and this kind of equalizes a direct appropriation with our expected spending for that type of service. In transit, I think the only thing that people might be interested in is a slight change there in that the appropriation for the Council on Transportation Access, I think it's called, which was a part of that rail bank property then was at the time leased to a company up there called Page and Hill, and we've continued to lease to that company. That company treats wood, and there has been significant soil contamination there as well as groundwater contamination, and there are some earlier cleanup efforts. To make a long story short, we need about $1 million to pay for MnDOT's share of the cleanup costs. MnDOT has been determined to be one of the responsible parties for that contamination, and so we expect to do this. There's another piece that we hopefully will have in the policy bill where we're going to also ask to then for the authority to deed this land to the company so that if there's future contamination, the state won't incur any more liability for that. In our state roads appropriation, this is our primary source of funding for all the activities that we perform on the trunk highway system and operations and maintenance. We are asking for an increase of $5 million from the Trunk Highway Fund in both years of the biennium for that appropriation, and that is to offset increased costs in diesel fuel and salt and other commodities and supplies that we use for our activities. Program planning and delivery, I believe, is largely the same. One of the changes in our plans for spending that money, however, is to increase our grants to regional development commissions. We have changed our relationship with those organizations. We have coordinated with them in the past for transportation planning, but reached an agreement with them for the future where we will actually ask them to do more of the planning for us in the local areas, and so we're asking to pay them a little bit more to do that. Switching over to page 5, then, economic recovery fund. So this is the ARRA funds that were originally appropriated to the department in 2009, and at the time that was approved, the legislature gave us the authority to continue to spend additional funds as we receive them up through fiscal year 2013. And so there are still opportunities out there, we believe, to get some more of the economic recovery funds as other states aren't able to use the funds that they originally allocated. So we're just asking for the authority to spend those should some of those become available to us in the future. Moving down to our state road construction appropriation, we are asking to increase the federal highway aid portion of that appropriation by $125.4 million in 2014 and $137.6 million in 2015. And that is as a result of two things. One is the MAP 21 bill gave us a little bit more money than we had originally expected in our previous forecast, and so this adjusts our spending level to accommodate some of that additional revenue that we expect to get. There's also a little bit of timing change that we incorporate in here because we've adjusted the schedule of a couple of big projects that the department plans to undertake in the next biennium. And by doing this, it allows us to better utilize our federal funds and match up our cash flow more appropriately.
What are those larger?
The two I know of, Mr. Chairman, are the St. Croix Bridge and the Winona Bridge.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And then on the highway user taxes portion, we're asking to increase the appropriation for 2014 by $95 million. The original governor's request was for $75 million, and as a result of a slight increase in the revenue forecast for the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, in the February forecast, we're asking to increase that $75 million to $95 million. And that $95 million will be used for a number of different things. I think members have heard about our SIMS program, Corridor Investment Management Strategy. It's a new program that the department is rolling out this year, and the solicitations for applications for that funding are actually already out.
Mr. Peterson, I'm just going to declare a quorum is present. Happily, didn't think that was going to happen. So, members, can we just quickly take a quick vote on the A1 amendment just to put this bill in the? We're not really taking action on the bill, but let's just put it in proper form. So, all in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Welcome, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly to finish up on that piece then. So in addition to the SIMS program, we're looking at expanding our spending and rehabilitation of some of the draining structures that we have out there. These are culverts and other minor roadside appurtenances that help us drain water away from the roadway. In addition to guardrail repair and sign repair, it gives us a chance to kind of catch up on our backlog of replacement in some of those areas. And then we also plan to take on some pavement rehabilitation work to add to our Better Roads program, which the legislature approved last biennium.
So, Mr. Peterson, do you have a sense of the relative proportion that you're going to spend in each of these three chunks?
Mr. Chairman, I do. Of the $95 million, we're looking to spend $5 million for ADA accommodation, $20 million for the drainage and guardrail replacement that I mentioned, $30 million for Sims, and $40 million for Better Roads.
And no, I'll ask later. Never mind. Go ahead.
Now, Mr. Chairman, to the Highway Debt Service appropriation here has been reduced, again, to reflect, I think, a little bit of a change in our cash flow estimates for the next biennium, but also largely related to a difference in the way we're now booking premiums on bond sales. The premiums affect the net interest rate that the department pays, and so we have an agreement with M&B to kind of alter the way we account for that, and so the changes that result from that are reflected in the changes in this appropriation request. I don't believe there's any change in electronic communications. In the local road section for county state aid roads as well as municipal state aid roads, there's a slight increase from the previous governor's recommendation, again, as a result of the slight increase in the revenue forecast for the highway user tax distribution fund for both of those. And so this is money that we primarily is just allocated out to the cities and counties as their share of the state aid proceeds of each of these years.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, just going back to the highway debt service.
Mm-hmm.
You dropped it in 14 biennium to, or 14 year down to 158, then it spikes up to 189. Can you explain that?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Peterson.
Yeah, Senator Osmick. We expect to sell quite a few bonds in fiscal year 14 in order to pay for our highway construction. The way the bonds work for our construction projects is the bond authorization comes with an appropriation, so we encumber against the appropriation, but we actually don't sell the bonds until we expect to have invoices come in from the contractor. And so we'll be, as I mentioned earlier, we have some new projects coming on as well as a number of fairly substantial construction projects underway right now that will require bond financing. And so I think our forecast actually for 2014 is about $480 million even of bond sales in 2014. So that's, I think, the largest reason. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on then to page 8, agency management. I don't think that there are any changes in the appropriations. We are asking for a slight change in our authority to spend money under our buildings appropriation at the top of page 9. Basically, that just gives us some flexibility within the biennium to fund building projects. We fund new buildings for MnDOT out of this appropriation, and these are smaller buildings like truck garages and salt sheds and things of those nature. And like our highway construction, sometimes because of the bigger numbers we're dealing with there, it helps to have flexibility to be able to reach forward or backward to appropriations in different years in order to get full funding for each of these projects and keep things moving in a timely fashion.
So, Mr. Peterson, as I was going through the budget, that kind of jumped out at me. This is kind of a new thing that we'll be doing at MnDOT. It's similar, of course, to how we deal with the road construction budget. But are there big building plans anticipated?
Mr. Chairman, no, not. There are no plans for big buildings,
uh-huh.
if that's your question. No,
or a lot of buildings?
Yeah, no.
a lot more money?
No, it's the amount of the appropriation is the same, I believe, as uh-huh. we have had in the previous biennium anyway. It's just in the past, we have run into issues where the cancellation or the having to wait for the next year's appropriation sometimes has caused us to have to delay schedules for a project. And also with some of these projects, you know, we go in with a contract. The final price of the building is often not exactly the same as the original contract. And so if there's, you know, money available from the previous year, for example, it's nice to be able to go back and just have the flexibility to put a financial plan together and keep things going. It doesn't increase our spending authority for the biennium.
So this isn't in anticipation of something down the line a ways, some big complex or campus that MnDOT's going to be building?
No, Mr. Chairman, I think it's really a response to some of the issues we've run into in the past.
Okay.
So, again, we have, I think, I want to say 140-some different locations around the state, each of which has buildings on it. And so there's, you know, as buildings age or they need replacement of their HVAC systems, new roofs, new salt sheds, which tend to be more shorter-lived structures, you know, this appropriation funds those types of activities. So they're capital improvements, new buildings and stuff. We're not anticipating any increase in our building activity. It's the same level of building activity, just, again, more flexibility with the appropriation.
Is this consistent with how admin and other agencies handle their building construction funds?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. I'd be interested in knowing that.
We'll see what I can find.
All right. I want to know what common and best practices across state agencies.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And then in the transfer section there, I think that's the same language. Until you get down to 9.3, we had some changes in our request for transfers from the flexible fund, which is the part of the 5% comes off the top of the highway user tax distribution fund. And we had earlier asked for some distributions to county and city turnbacks, and we are reassessing some of those plans. And my understanding is that the current language is now better reflects what are now our current plans for turnbacks in the next biennium. And the it's also my understanding that the $3.7 million transfer to the Trunk Highway Fund, 9.33, which is an addition from the previous bill, is primarily to help complete the financing plan on the Highway 101 project, which is a flood mitigation, bridge improvement, highway turnback project that would connect Scott County to Carver County just north of the city of Shakopee. And there are multiple partners involved in that project. There's county roads and trunk highway. And so we had earlier had some money slotted for that, and it got diverted to another project. And so this helps us kind of complete that financing package so that project can move forward on time.
Okay. Mr. Peterson, we were talking about this a few days ago. I see that notice needs to be made if these transfers occur. To the chairs and the ranking members. And I don't remember ever seeing one like this. Has this not happened in a while, or has it happened recently, or does it just not happen very often?
Mr. Chairman, it's my recollection that that happens about every year, and I think that we send a memo over.
Okay.
I personally have seen those memos go over, and they're kind of dry and you know,
easy to miss.
Formulaic, but they outline the details of the money transfers. In particular, I know within our operating appropriations for operations and maintenance and program delivery and agency management, you know, as the years evolve and our work plan adjust, we quite often transfer money between those appropriations in particular.
Maybe we need to figure out a way to printed on a different color paper or something. It's a fairly significant, fairly significant latitude that we give MnDOT to do this. A lot of other agencies just absolutely, it's transferring funds outside of the appropriations process by the legislature, and that's pretty important. So maybe we need to figure out a way to keep closer track of this or have a better line of communication between MnDOT and the legislature when that happens.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to work with you to try to identify a
Significant accommodation to MnDOT, a lot of flexibility occurring outside of the appropriations process, and it's gotten my attention. Thanks.
Yep, you're welcome. And, Mr. Chairman, I think that brings us to the end of the MnDOT portion of the appropriation section. I know there are a couple of policy provisions towards the end of the bill that I could go over if you want to just jump to those.
Yeah, could we discuss those? Thanks.
Yes. Find the page here.
Page 10.
Article 2 on page 17, we are establishing in statute, I believe, here the Transportation Economic Development Assistance Program. You may recall that the governor has proposed a $10 million appropriation from the general fund each year for the TED program. That appropriation is going to appear in the economic development bill, as I understand it. But the policy language that establishes the program is here in the bill. It runs throughout page 18 to line 19.8, I believe. And then on line 19.9, Trunk Highway Fund Appropriation Subdivision 3 there, the new language, payments to minute services, that's just to clarify that we can use Trunk Highway funds to pay for IT support from minute and but just the actual costs that are incurred for Trunk Highway purposes. On the next section, beginning on 19.19, the grade crossing safety count, basically it gives the commissioner some discretion to not cancel funds at the end of a year, cancel appropriations after the first year of the biennium, so that that money can continue to be spent in the second year, and it may cancel to the Trunk Highway Fund. So it gives the commissioner the flexibility. Again, these funds go out to pay for projects to either replace antiquated rail grade crossing control equipment or to add active controls to rail grade crossings that currently do not have active controls. Those projects, again, sometimes the schedule doesn't completely align with our fiscal years, and so this, again, has been a problem in the past, in particular for this program, and is trying to, again, make reasonable progress and good use of the appropriations that come to the department. Not increasing the amount of money in this respect that we're asking to spend for this program, just more flexibility within the biennium for these expenditures. And then on, I think the last piece is the final section on page 22, financial assistance for North Star Commuter Rail expenses of Greater Minnesota, 22.18. Right now, the Greater Minnesota Transit appropriation pays for a portion of the North Star Commuter Rail operating costs. It's that share of the commuter rail operations that are associated with the length of the line in Sherburne County, which is outside the Metro Council's jurisdiction. In the past, in order to get money to North Star operations, we've had to make a grant from the Greater Minnesota Transit account to Sherburne County, and then Sherburne County makes the transfer to North Star. And this just allows us to make the transfer directly to North Star and without having to go through the grant process.
All right. Thank you. Couple of things. Can we quickly go back to page 10? I think this is just language that we pick up every year, the use of state road construction appropriations and the contingent appropriation, but can you just explain to members what those are?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, that is a language that appeared in the last biennium's bill anyway. That's changed a little bit in the last few biennium, but basically if there's a change in our forecast for revenue or sometimes it's a change in our plans for financing projects or a change in our expectations for federal funds, we have the opportunity to increase our spending in order to get more projects under contract sooner. So this gives us the ability to ask the legislature to increase that authority through this contingent appropriation authority. So as it says, approval of the governor and written approval of at least five members of a group and of the members of the Legislative Advisory Commission and the ranking minority members. And so, and then it refers to may transfer all or part of the unappropriated balance in the Trunk Highway Fund to an appropriation for trunk highway design, construction, inspection in order to take advantage of unanticipated receipt of income or take advantage of federal advanced construction funding. And for members who may not be familiar with that phrase, It's the advanced construction funding is something the department uses, again, to kind of balance our use of federal funds so that we can get more projects under contract sooner. And in the past, we came to the legislature with this originally in 2003, and there was some concern about making sure that the legislature was fully informed about how the department planned to use that, and so that piece was added at that time, or after that.
Great. Thank you. All right. Thanks, Mr. Peterson. Questions, members? Wow, you did a fantastic job with that. All right. I didn't know I had this question. dollars for municipal turnbacks. Looks like we don't have anything earmarked or noted.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. My understanding is that this spending for turnbacks is managed through the CASA appropriation, and so that even though there are no specific turnbacks identified or the amount of money spent for each of the turnback accounts, each meaning the county and municipal turnbacks, that the money for turnbacks from the flexible fund is originally deposited in the county state aid fund, and so the numbers that we're appropriating in the bill cover that amount. If the my understanding, detailed information about our plans for that are listed on the department's website, and we can provide that information to the committee if they would like to see that.
Okay.
But that,
we'll figure out if the committee needs to see that. We can work with Michael on that. Great. Thanks. Anything further, members?
Chairman.
Senator Thomason.
Chairman, just out of the appropriations on the front page, are they contingent on increases in taxes or fees or anything in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomasoni, the Department of Transportation appropriations are not.
Okay.
I guess, yeah, that would be true. I was going to say except for the general fund for the TED program, but that's actually not in this bill, so, yeah.
Right, but it will be on Monday. but there is some assumption of some additional monies coming through the MAP 21 federal surface transportation reauthorization.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. Our federal fund forecasting is always a bit of art and science. We don't truly know what our federal funds for a given fiscal year will be until the Congress appropriates them. The MAP 21 or the multi-year transportation authorization bill gives us kind of a multi-year peek into what they're likely to be, and we use that as a guide. And so, yeah, the federal fund spending in there is somewhat dependent upon Congress coming up with additional revenue for the Federal Highway Trust Fund.
Do you, Mr. Pearson, do you discount the authorization by any factor, or, you know, anticipating the appropriation being somewhat less than the authorization, or how do you manage that?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, we look at history to guide us, and just for other members who may not be as familiar, the spending levels that are contained in the authorization bills contain what are called guaranteed contract authority. So for each of the programs in the bill, where the department is guaranteed the authority to spend at least that much. However, the annual appropriation for spending against those totals is never equal to 100% of all that guaranteed contract authority combined for all the programs. So it's somewhat less. And so in our recent estimates, I think we use like 95% of that authorized level as our estimate for actual spendable money.
Great. Thank you. And Senator Thomasoni, just, you know, some of the additional dollars just come from additional appropriation authorization from the Trunk Highway Fund. So we're spending down the Trunk Highway Fund more than we have in the past for state road construction purposes and maintenance purposes. So that's where some of the additional money comes from. All right. Anything further, members? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chair, are we on also the spreadsheet as well? Are we just on the actual bill? They somewhat tie together.
Yes. Yeah. I was kind of following both along.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I could go ahead and ask a question
based
on this then?
Absolutely.
Because I didn't have the time to go see where the language is.
Absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm noticing under the Metropolitan Council, the current biennium is 78.
Senator Kiffmeyer, we'll have the Met Council presentation now, if you want to hear that. We haven't heard from them yet.
Absolutely, that would be great. I just saw the
All right.
testifier there, so that was a good time.
We haven't
first
heard from...
to hear, that would be
great. Thanks. Okay. All right, anything further from MnDOT? Great. So next we'll hear from the Met Council, and then we'll hear the transportation, the state highway patrol portion of the public safety piece, and then we'll get into the public safety pieces of the public safety piece after that. Welcome, Chair Haig.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. There is should be a handout in your packet that looks like this that says Metropolitan Council Budget Overview for 2014 and 2015. And if you would flip to the third page of that, the Governor's Budget Proposal, this is the comparison between the Governor's original budget and the Governor's Supplemental Budget Proposal. You can see that in his initial budget, the governor proposed a quarter-cent sales tax increase in the seven-county metro area based on the broadened sales tax base with a supplemental budget and the no longer broadened sales tax base. The governor has proposed a half-cent sales tax for the seven metro county area. You can see the amount of revenue in the governor's supplemental budget. It would raise approximately $230 million a year once it's fully implemented in the next biennium. For this year, for this next biennium, it's a total of about $317 million. If you turn to the next page to understand how this relates to the state general fund and what some of this revenue actually produces, you can see that today we have an $18 million shortfall in the state share of the operating cost for LRT. This revenue would also help to fund $118 million for the state share of the capital costs for Southwest LRT. That would otherwise have to come from the GO bond fund. It also relieves the general fund of current and future transitway operating costs significantly into the future. And it would relieve the state's GO bonding share for transitways into the future as well. For this biennium, significantly, it provides a one-time reduction in the state's general transport and general fund appropriation to the Met Council for Transit of a total of about $23.4 million a year. So that reduction is a total of $46.8 million over the biennium. And that's because the cash accumulates early in this process, and we can still build out the map that I will show you as we go forward. If you turn to the next slide, what's significant about the governor's budget proposals, it really ends those one-time fixes we've had for both transit capital and operating. Over the last decade, there have been probably over $100 million in one-time fixes, shifts onto the property tax, maybe a one-time state appropriation, use of some federal money that came in. So we've always had to kind of cobble together a series of funds to try to keep the transit system fully operating. The governor's budget proposal provides a sustainable, reliable funding going forward, and it really helps us as a region stay competitive with other regions. It is a easy to administer and collect source. It does keep pace with economic growth and population growth. We're projecting that in the metro area, we're going to see about 900,000 more people here in the next 30 years. And not only does it benefit the transit services that are provided to people who use transit, it also helps to relieve congestion on highways in the metro area. The budget proposal also really is important about economic development. Expanding transit helps people get access to jobs throughout the region. It allows them, that's a benefit both to employers who are seeking to expand. They have a broader labor shed to draw from, and certainly it helps workers have a range of jobs that are more open to them in that process. And what we're seeing significantly is how the fixed guideways, the LRT and the BRT, really do spur economic development. The Green Line Central Corridor is going to open in 2014. And the latest data that we have is that since 2012, we now have $1.6 billion in building permits that have been pulled along that corridor in anticipation of this development. So the transit improvements really reduce congestion, and that helps shippers moving their products throughout the region. So there's really multiple benefits for job growth and economic development. This budget proposal is really about a multimodal system. It's not just an investment in rail, but it really is an investment in bus and all types of bus service, regular route bus, express bus, and also helps with pedestrian and bike access in the metro area. It allows us to make those multimodal connections because people get to buses and trains by walking or biking. We see more and more use of bikes on our trains and buses all the time. This proposal will help to support that. If you flip to the next slide, just shows you the operations funding and the tax policy goals. It really is consistent with the governor's overall goals to have a fair and balanced budget. You can see with this additional revenue that produced in the metropolitan area that shifts the relative share that each of the revenue sources provide. So the ongoing state general funds would really just be focused on our metro mobility services. Those are the services for people with disabilities who need a dial-a-ride type service. I know people often ask about farebox recovery. We are right now recovering about 27.9% farebox recovery. This is really one of the highest farebox recoveries in the country. It's over the median of our competitor systems. The only outlier system is San Diego, and they run a particular transit service down to Tijuana, and we certainly aren't going to have that soon here, and that's why theirs is so high. Without new revenue, our metro transit is facing some serious challenges. We have continued operating expense for Hiawatha LRT. We'll bring the Central Corridor LRT project on in this next biennium. And so this additional sales tax revenue really addresses those issues going forward. And significantly, it helps us move forward with the Southwest LRT project. We're in preliminary engineering on that project. And we would be set to open that project in 2018 if we can get this additional resource this year. If you turn to pages, the final couple of pages, I can show you what happens if we don't do anything. We would have to reduce service levels. We'd have to have fare increases. And really, our service just doesn't keep up with population growth and demand, and it would increase congestion throughout the region. Other regions turn to the sales tax to fund regional transit systems. It ranges anywhere from 0.75 cents all the way up to 1.8 cents, and you can see the chart that shows you how other regions look to the sales tax and why that's important for us here in the Twin Cities. And then finally, the map at the very end of the presentation shows you exactly what this additional sales tax revenue will buy. It will create up to 21 transit ways over the next 20 years. That would include 3 new light rail transit lines, the Southwest Line, the Bottineau Corridor, which is the extension of the blue line there on the map up to the north, And then potentially the Gateway Corridor out to the east, which is on your map in kind of an olive color. It would also allow us to create six new highway BRT or managed lanes on our freeways within the metro, and then 12 arterial BRTs, which are shown in yellow. So it really also provides for a 1% annual growth in the regular route bus service, which includes all of the service providers in the metro area, Metro Transit and the suburban transit providers as well. So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thanks. Questions, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Hay, you talked about fare increases and fare box recovery. You know, I'm thinking down in my area where we have a pretty long commute to downtown, and in all honesty, it's a bargain. And have you looked at fare increases? What might that do to your ridership, and how much of your recovery and how much of the $18 million of the operating costs could be covered versus having to come out of the state appropriation?
Well, the fare box is an important source of revenue for the transit system. It can't really allow for the type of capital growth and the expansion of the system. Generally, fare boxes have allowed us to try to keep up with inflation, increase fuel cost, those types of increases in the system. So significant increases in the percentage of fares that are recovered. We have different fare box recovers for different modes of transit service. Some recover more, some are more expensive than others. The Metro Mobility one I mentioned is probably one of our very most expensive ones. So there are some are more productive and some cost more because of the type of service.
Let me thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just ask the question the other way. You talked about the status quo outcomes. Are fare increases part of your strategy?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, absolutely. We continue to look at fare box recovery always as we see the balance of all the different revenues. We go through an analysis of, you know, really what the market will bear. There's always a point at which if you increase the fares too much, you're going to reduce ridership, and then you're going to lose your overall revenue. So we do that all the time. I think our last fare increase was in
October of
2008. So we probably do those anywhere from every 3 to 5 years. That'd be a typical pattern where we'd go and look at the whole system-wide. We've certainly made adjustments in fares within that time, but of the whole system, we really have not done that since 2008.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Osmick, and then Senator Kiffmeyer will get to your spreadsheet question. Thanks. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the half-cent sales tax, you talk about a lot of transportation spending. How much of that is going to be put into roads and bridges as opposed to the other modes of transportation?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, the sales tax in this portion of the governor's budget is primarily for transit, but because we work cooperatively with MnDOT on those BRTs that are on the highway and the managed lanes, usually MnDOT brings some of their highway funding for that, and then we bring some of our BRT, our bus rapid transit funding to make those two things work together. This revenue source would be going for both transit capital and transit expansion.
Mr. Chair and
Senator Osmond.
So the answer to this is out of the half-cent sales tax, absolutely nothing is going into roads and bridges.
I'd say that's fair. I'd say most the vast majority of this money will be for transit capital and operations. So that's fleet replacement, capital expansion, park and rides, all of the components of that transit system in addition to operations.
Okay. I appreciate that answer. That's what I was trying to get to. The other component, Mr. Chair, and to Commissioner Haig, when you're giving us information about how this is going to reduce congestion, do you have any measurements right now that you can make when we're starting towards the Southwest Corridor, that we can have some legitimate surveys and some legitimate estimates done right now on the most widely traveled patterns, which would be Crosstown 62, perhaps some 394, where we can have some level of actual physical count estimates when Southwest comes online. I'm assuming it's going to, regardless of how I vote. Do we have in place measurements at which point we can, after a certain length of time, actually identify if it did have any kind of benefit in reducing congestion?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator, as part of the engineering process for the Southwest LRT project, we will look at all of those factors, travel time savings, impact on additional transit service. There's a variety of economic factors that we look at, and as we prepare those, that'll get done probably in this next 18-month period. You know, we'd be happy to share that with you.
So, Mr. Chair, so there'll be a hard count on the majority, on the most heavily traveled areas, so that when we start this, we're going to actually have an apples-to-apples comparison of what the actual impact did, because I'm not sure that we saw that when we did Hiawatha. I'm sure there may be something that I haven't ever seen it, but that's 10 years ago. I'm thinking going into the future, we want to make sure that we actually are getting a reduction in congestion.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, the Itasca project also did a comprehensive analytics study of the return on investment for the region as a whole with the build-out of the system. And in that, they, you know, monetize the travel time savings, the impact on shippers, and I'd be happy to provide you with that information. That was done by, you know, high-level transportation planning analytics firm out of Massachusetts, and it has some very good comprehensive data that I think you'd like to see.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner Haig, my question is based upon a comparison graph that we have here that goes 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 for the Metropolitan Council.
This is
the total.
You have the spreadsheet.
The base was reduced, and then it was
is $78 million for this current biennium, plus a bit, $83 million for 14, 15, plus a bit. But it increases in 16-17 to 127. That's about a 50% increase. So could you maybe explain or show me where in the bill how that happens?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm going to ask Judge Shetnan to give you the detail on this, but in general, the restoration of the base was part of the approval of the budget bill last year, and the increased expenses really represent the increased operating expenses for the expansion of the system.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm Judd Shetnan. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. And Senator Kiffmeyer, what Chair Haig just mentioned is correct. What it doesn't show for the previous biennium of what the previous base was, in the previous base was the 129,859. As part of the budget negotiation that occurred 2 years ago, there was a $52 million general fund reduction that was paid through a CTIB contribution of up to 75% of our transitways. There was an STA, the opt-out providers, reductions to their reserves. The council paid through part of our reserves, and the and then there was some federal money that went into that. And then, as also part of that negotiation, the base was restored up to $129 million. So the base is just back to where we began. And what the governor has proposed then is a $23.4 million reduction in both state fiscal year 14 and state fiscal year 15 to reduce $46.8 million as part of this budget negotiation. But we're able to address what we are talking about in our budget proposal through the sales tax, which otherwise we'd need the $129 million plus the $18 million on top of that in order to just provide the status quo service that we have today. And without the sales tax, and with the sales tax, not only will we be able to cover that, but we'll be able to begin to grow the system in the way that Chair Haig has outlined for you. I hope that answers your
question. That explains it, Mr. Chairman, whether I you know, whatever.
good question. Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Mm-hmm. Just a quick question of my own, Chair Haig or Mr. Shetnin. The LRT operating shortfall on the slides aren't numbered on this slide. Of 9.2 for Hiawatha and 8.8 for Central. Is Hiawatha considered a gap?
Mr. Chair,
and members, the Hiawatha is considered a gap because it is the piece above the 50% that the state is required to pay through statute that the council has been funding.
Oh, I see.
So, again, it was part of the budget discussion that we had a couple years ago, and so this just brings us up to the state statutory language. I believe it's 473.510, something like that, that has the language that requires the 50% state share. And so you will see the $8.8 million on Central Corridor is also the state share of the 50% of the operations that the
CTIB
state
was otherwise picking up.
That CTIB is paying their 50%. Right. The statute has us come back and ask the legislature to pay for that out of the general fund or some other way, and through our proposal, we're proposing to pay for that out of the sales tax, so that takes that off of this off of the state's dime from here on out, is a significant savings to the state.
I see. Thank you. All right. Anything further, members? All right.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
I know some folks want to testify on the governor's budget, but why don't we hear first on the DPS piece? Ms. Ellison is here to help us with that, and then we'll take testimony. And where's the language? Oh, and Commissioner Doman, welcome. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, and members, good morning. We are here today to present the budget. We appreciate your time. And so you know, we have all of our division directors here, too. If you have more specific questions than what we can answer after the presentation, we'll be happy to do that as
Thank
well.
You. Thank you.
And I have asked Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison to present for us today.
For now, we're just doing the transportation pieces. And then we'll get to the rest of the DPS budget.
We'll take
testimony from folks. I think there are folks who want to testify just on the transportation pieces, or at least one person who does. And then we'll jump over to the larger public safety pieces. All right, thanks. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Excuse me, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. As you suggested, we will first go through the transportation portions of our budget and reference the governor's change items. And then after the testimony, we'll present the public safety items in the budget.
So, members, I think we're not working off the A1 now. Is that correct? We're back to the bill as introduced.
I'm sorry. This incorporates the change items.
So what where are we? Use what document we're working off of here.
We'd be working off the A1, which is now the bill.
Hang on one sec. I'm finding myself. Oh, there we are. Okay, I apologize. Yes, A1 starting on page 11, line 11.17. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I came with the original budget, and then I switched my notes over to the A1, so I was a little nervous that you were going to go back to the original budget. The governor's budget requests an overall increase in the public safety area of 2.9% compared to the prior biennium or our base budget. And the items that I will go through are the change items. And if you look on page 12, the first item that I will mention is the requested increase for soft body armor. The increase from the general fund is for $92,000 and from the trunk highway fund for $100,000 per year. The state reimburses local law enforcement officers for 50% of the costs of bulletproof soft body armor. We have found over the years that we are always running out of funds midpoint during the year. Last year, the legislature gave us a one-time increase so that we could get caught up and get rid of the backlog of requests for soft body armor. But this request at is to, so that we can maintain staying on target with having sufficient funds to cover the costs of those vests. The next request for increase is on page 13 of the is represented on page 13 of the A1 amendment, and there is an increase of $1 million per year for the State Patrol for the costs of fuel, and then also the additional money for the soft body armor is represented from the Trunk Highway Fund, and that covers the costs of soft body armor for state troopers, and state troopers are paid through the Trunk Highway Fund.
And if you don't mind, Ms. Ellison, I'll just, because we're jumping quite a bit on the spreadsheet, members, that's on line 192 of the spreadsheet, page 6. Thank you.
The next area that is a change item is on page 14, and it is 14.11, capital security. The governor is requesting an additional $1.5 million per year for capital security, and that money specifically is to be used for the creation of an emergency manager position and also for an increase in the number of State Patrol troopers and other security officers at the State Capitol Complex.
That's line 206 on the spreadsheet, members.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmond.
Just a question on that particular issue. You described one FTE. How many additional FTEs are you talking about with this $1.5 million?
Ms. Dolman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick, it would be dependent upon salaries and that sort at the time this was implemented, but our preliminary thoughts are the emergency manager and maybe five additional troopers.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next item is on page 15 of the A1 amendment. Line 15.17, we are requesting an additional spending authority from the Vehicle Services Special Revenue Account so that we can hire seven additional people in our title processing division. As you know, we've had a great deal of difficulty keeping up with processing motor vehicle titles. We've had a process improvement person. We've increased our production substantially. But in looking at all the process improvement information that we've gathered, we do need those additional people in order to maintain a title turnaround of 30 days or less. The other request is on line 15.20, and that's for an addition of $98,000 per year to begin the purchase of a new phone system for DVS. Our current phone system is outliving its life expectancy. We're only able to handle about 17% of the calls without having them be put on hold, and we are moving to interactive voicemail system so that we can handle more and more of the routine transactions over the phone and free up staff to handle the more complex transactions. So that phone system will be replaced over a several-year period, but the request to begin that is for $98,000 in the second year of the biennium.
So, yeah, I see. So, members, these two items are on lines 224 and 225. And I see on the phone system in the tails we have $423,000. Does that then extend beyond the next biennium, the phone system replacement costs? Are there further out tails? Do we know?
Mr. Chair, I'm just looking for the detail on that. Yes, the for fiscal year 16, the request is for $400,000, and then it drops to fiscal year 17 of $250,000. So the 16-17 biennium would be a total request for increased spending authority of $650,000.
I have 260 and 163 for a total of 423 on the spreadsheet. And then my question was beyond 16-17.
Mr. Chair, what I have here is Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure what I have here. I have a sheet that is different from the sheet that you have, so I'm wondering if Ms. McCormick could come up and clarify that. I have the same numbers that I provided you for 16 and 17, but I'm going to ask Ms. McCormick to walk you through that.
Great. Thank you. Sorry. Okay. All right. Thank you. Welcome, Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services. And on the spreadsheet that you have in front of you, as you can see, there are extending costs in the next biennium that are listed for 2016 and 2017.
I think I might have figured it out.
It's split.
Are some of these dollars coming out of the driver services and some are coming out of vehicle services? I see an additional line on line 237, so we need to add those two lines together.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There's funding coming from both special revenue accounts because we're handling all the phone calls from across the division.
I see. Okay, thanks. That helps. But then what about beyond 16-17? Is there going to be additional expense going on into the future to replace this phone system? Or are the upfront capital costs fully paid for by the end of the subsequent biennium?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, from my information, we would have it paid through by the next biennium, but then, of course, there are operational costs and those kind of upgrading technology if necessary and those kinds of things.
Great. Thanks. That helps. All right. Appreciate it. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question in regards to that. Are you converting then to a VoIP system instead of a regular landline?
McCormick.
Voice over IP.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, the system would, we already have an interactive voice response as part of our system so that you can do, what we're hoping to do is automate as many transactions as possible so that when we need to talk to an actual person, we've freed up our staff so that we're answering calls as they come in and we're not having to have people on hold. We already do some electronically that you're able to do transactions, but we're hoping to get to more complex transactions over the phone that we wouldn't be able to handle with our current system, which was developed in about 2000, I think.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, whether it'll be a voice over IP will be dependent upon what system we end up purchasing, and that will be done in partnership with Minute IT.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I suspect this is more software-related programming than the technology necessarily, but that's fine. That's all I needed to know. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. All right.
All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, moving on. Page 16 of the A1 amendment, there's a request for $71,000 in the second year. Again, increased appropriation authority from the Special Revenue Fund to hire a person to manage our facial recognition fraud prevention program. We did present that program previously to this committee, but we use a facial recognition system, and now it's going to be a real-time system to compare photographs to identify potential fraud. And we have federal grants to cover the costs of the staffing until the second year of the biennium. So beginning that second year, we are requesting this additional money to pay for a staff to manage that unit. Then, Mr. Chair, the only other policy item that I would mention is on page 20 of the A1 amendment, and again, the powers and duties. This relates to capital security. I just direct your attention to 20.19 to 20.22. The Commissioner of Public Safety shall have the final authority regarding public safety and security in the Capitol complex. The Commissioner of Administration shall have the powers, duties, and responsibilities to relating to the Capitol complex of state-owned buildings as provided in Chapter 16B.
And that's a part of the recommendations of the task force. Did you just say that?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
I was just going to comment because I think so often we talk about general fund here and realizing that the customers are paying for the service. In other words, through the fees and things that they do. So getting a better phone system or getting customer service or getting the titling services done, this is paid for in that regard out of those fees. And so I think we always want to be judicious in the use of them, but this is what they really need and want, and I'm glad to see this being done.
Senator Kiffmeyer, I agree completely, and that'll probably come up in a few minutes. thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Further? Senator Sendrum.
This may not be worth asking, but it may at some point down into history on this last policy change. Is it conceivable at some point in time, given, let's just say we had a Wisconsin right to work issue going on in the Capitol and the Rules and Administration Committee had some thoughts about how we ought to handle this from the standpoint of just general safety and security, would giving away or at least anointing this authority with the Department of Public Safety take away at all the ability for the Legislative Rules and Administration Committee to take actions that they thought was important from the standpoint of the Capitol security? In other words, could we get into a tug-of-war at some point?
Commissioner Doman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sinjum, I would like to think that the safety of everybody at the Capitol, legislators, citizens who come here would come first if we were ever to get in a situation where maybe we didn't completely agree. But from my perspective, as long as I have the opportunity to serve, and I've had this conversation with Senator Dibble, I'm about working collaboratively to make sure that the people of Minnesota come first. And so I can't imagine making any of these decisions in a vacuum and would certainly work with whoever needed to be at the table to make those decisions, unless they were time-sensitive or very critical and needed immediate action.
Probably understandable. Thank you. Just thought I'd ask.
It's a good question. Hang on to it. It's worth noodling over. Appreciate it. All right. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question on page 16, line 1. This is a curious. I didn't even think about it, but I'm really curious why we would have $1,000 out of Trunk Highway. It's an incredibly small amount considering the millions we're dealing with. Can you explain that line item? I'm just sort of curious on what that $1,000 is.
$1,000.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmond, I'm sorry, would you point that out?
So it's in page 16, line 1. It's Trunk Highway coming out of the driver services area. I mean, I don't know if that's for like a lot of cookies or something. $1,000 seems a lot. Strange.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmond, there are historically, I'm not sure what that $1,000 is for, frankly, but there historically have been a lot of transfer of funds from Trunk Highway to General to backfill for certain expenses. And those are accounting situations that maybe Krista Boyd has the history on, but I know that there's just been a history of taking general fund to backfill for Trunk Highway costs or Trunk Highway. So the short answer is I'm not sure. I think it would take some historical look back and justification for why those transfers were made and are continued to be made.
This is like dust on the budget dust. That's a good catch. Ms. Boyd, do you know?
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, I don't have a definitive answer for you. It's my understanding that the $1,000 is in some way related to driver services pieces of DWI license treatment, revocations or reinstatement, something to that. I don't have the detail on it. I don't know if this is instead linked to transfers such as those made under the public safety support rider language, but, we can get more information for the committee on that.
We should spend $1,000 finding out what this thousand. No, I'm kidding. Oh, we should.
Sure,
no,
that's why I worried about bringing it up. We spend more
sometimes
money dealing.
It's actually sometimes the legislature gets much, much more interested in the smaller amounts of money because we can get our minds around it. I've seen that a lot. The big dollars are like, oh, sure, whatever. Yeah. And then we're like really interested in $5,000. Great. Questions, members? Anything further on the transportation pieces of public safety? All right. Thank you, Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner. I think Mr. Shorer wants to testify on the governor's bill, the transportation piece. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Dibble, members of the committee. Thank you for having me and for your time this morning. We are here, as we have been a little bit before, because our members are so concerned about having a robust transit system as part of forming a robust business climate in the region.
Mr. Shorer, just please introduce yourself.
I'm diving right in. Will Schroer, Minneapolis Regional Chamber of Commerce and St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce, although today I'm speaking just for the Minneapolis Regional Chamber. We've been here before to talk about transit as being a vital part of the regional business environment that makes us home to so many Fortune 500 companies and mid and small businesses as well. It moves people around today. Our downtowns and many of our suburbs literally would not work without the capacity that transit makes possible today. We're interested in a more robust system, not only to keep the region moving, but also to become and stay the kind of place that attracts the talent that our members are going to need going forward. We have been part of three major studies over the past year. The Metropolitan Council and Counties Transit Improvement Board Program of Projects study, looking at the ability to build more than one line every 10 years, as we have been doing. The Itasca Project's Return on Investment Study, which looked at would building that program of projects produce a return on investment for the region. It would, and in response to Senator Osmek's question earlier, we found that most of that substantial return to the region would actually accrue to folks using the roads because it's an integrated transportation system, and when one part doesn't work, the whole thing doesn't work. And so while the money that we're looking for to invest in transit would go to a transit construction program, the money would go to benefit everybody. And the third major study then was the Governor's Transportation Finance Advisory Committee, looking, among other things, at the results of the first two studies. Program of Projects and Return on Investment looked at the money necessary to build that system that Chair Haig was speaking of, recommended in that case then building that project or building that system with a half-cent increase in the regional sales tax, made that recommendation. That showed up in the governor's budget, and we're here today to endorse up to that half-cent recommended in the governor's budget. Because it would produce high returns, and because we're not going to be competitive if we don't have that system, and that's just the bottom line. Let me just make a couple of smaller points underneath that endorsement, if I may. Our support is based on that money being used to build out the program of projects and operate it on schedule. Second, our support is contingent on there not being a lot of other tax increases on the business community, and we could talk about what that means. And then third, ideally, and we have said this to this committee before and to your counterparts in the House, we see the regional transit system and the regional transportation system as a statewide asset. The metropolitan region produces an enormous share of the state's economic activity. It has generally been the case that the legislature sees the regional transportation system as a statewide asset and participates in its construction and operation. We'd like to see that continue going forward on both the capital and operating side. But I come actually from our Good Morning Minneapolis event where we had Speaker Thiessen and the governor's advisor, Kathy Thunheim, and Representative Keith Ellison speaking to us this morning. And Kathy Thunheim, in particular said, you know, I work now, I advise the governor, but I come out of obviously operating a business background. The single most important thing from a business perspective is to have certainty. It's not the only thing, but it's incredibly important to know what your environment looks like going forward. And so while we want to see substantial state participation still in constructing and operating the system, what we're most interested in is having the certainty that we're going to have a competitive transit system. Greater MSP, our partners in the economic development field, tell us that the first question that they get from site selectors is always about our workforce. We're working on that as well. The second question they get is, show us your transit investment map. We don't have to have the system in place today that some of our competitors have, although it would be better if we did. We need to have the plan to show them. And if we don't, we are going to continue to lose investment to places like Denver and Salt Lake that have put their transit construction and operation on a sustainable footing. That's mostly what we're interested in. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Shore, I think this is tremendous. And so let me convey my thanks and my regards to the business community stepping up. This is absolutely what has to happen and what, you know, we knew was a necessary ingredient in 2008 when we were able to take a little, you know, a smaller step. At that time, I see Cher Knudsen, the AFL-CIO here. We saw labor and business coming together to really talk about what the investment is needed to really bolster our economy. So I think this is big news, and I think it's tremendous, and I'm extremely grateful. So thank you. Thank you for that. Questions, members? All right. Great. I think
thank
we'll
you.
Hear from you in a few minutes as well. All right. All right. We are now going to hear the rest of the other jurisdiction of this committee. The rest of... Oh, okay. That's right. So, members, this is how this happens. We're going to presently lay the A1 on the table. Laid on the table because the bills, as they were drafted, the public safety pieces actually were drafted that we have jurisdiction over, were drafted to the bill that landed in Senator Latz's committee. So we're going to take a look at that bill. So we are laying Senate File 694 as amended on the table. All right. Now we look at Senate File 671. And we have, again, Deputy Commissioner Ellison and Commissioner Doman here with us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can certainly go through Senate File 671. But, however, Chris Turner passed out a sheet that is a nice overall summary of the change items. So right. Which would you like me to use?
Why don't we go with Mr. Turner's sheet, if that's easier for us to decipher and comprehend. Is that in our packets?
I just handed out.
So it's stapled to the summary. All right.
Mr. Chair, are you ready for me to proceed?
I am ready. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. The governor's budget requests overall would result in a 7.3% increase for the biennium for the Department of Public Safety. And let me walk through the different change items. And then, again, as the commissioner said, we have people in the audience that could certainly address detailed questions. The first one that I'll mention is on page 3 of Mr. Turner's handout, and that is the Minnesota School Safety Center. As we talked about in the original presentation on our budget before this committee, we used to have a school safety center that was funded through federal grants. Those federal grants were reduced substantially, and it was ultimately not funded previously by the legislature. However, the governor would like to reinstate that school safety center in order to provide emergency preparedness, response, and recovery to schools and for law enforcement community partners. The request is for $1,060,000 for the biennium.
And I'll just help members also keep track on the spreadsheet. Members, that's line 261 on page 8.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the next item is for replacement of the 20-year-old criminal history system. As we pointed out when we presented this originally to the committee, the system is very much in need of replacement. It's been a request that's been on the back burner because of the budget difficulties that the state has had. This system serves the entire criminal justice system in the state of Minnesota. It is vital for law enforcement, for the courts, for the operation and short of the criminal justice system. The request here is for $160,000 from the general fund, and then a rather unusual one-time request to transfer money from the driver vehicle services special operating accounts to the general fund so that we could replace this system, and that request is for $8 million in one-time transfer of funds.
Thanks, and as you know, I have serious concern about using those dollars. Senator mm-hmm. Kiffmeyer shares
Absolutely.
That concern, so we'll have further conversation over the weekend about that.
The next item is similar in that it replaces a system that is used by the criminal justice system. It's to replace our crime reporting system. We need to report crimes to the FBI. Our federal funding and the funding of every state in terms of federal grants is dependent upon the data that we comply. That system, again, is old. It's been a request that's been on hold for some time, and the request is for $720,000 from the general fund over the biennium, and then a one-time transfer of $2 million from the vehicle services account to replace that system.
And I'll just say what I just said.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just so you understand, when these proposals were adopted, we were encouraged to, for large ticket items like this, to really try to find anything in our agencies that could help out, at least on a one-time basis, and reducing some of the stress on the general fund. So just so you know, that was the intention behind it.
Yeah, but
and we understand
Allison,
the concern.
It directly contravenes state law that governs, you know, why we raise fees and in what dollar amounts. And so, and it really kind of works in contrast to the larger stated values and objectives and goals of the larger governor's budget. So it's really becomes an outlier in that whole conversation about if it's important and if it matters, we pay for it, and we pay for it with dollars that are transparent and accountable and have some relationship to the service that's being provided. And so it's hard to maintain that message if it's not consistent across the budget.
Mr. Chair, we understand that completely.
Right, thanks. Senator Wigger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, may I go back to the School Safety Center?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Ms. Ellingson, for schools, are we looking primarily at public or all schools and early learning through college? And that's one question, the definition. And then some of the benchmarks would be development of a safety plan. Would this be voluntary? I could expand on that a bit more.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to ask Chris Eide to come up and talk a little bit more of the details. But I believe that primarily it would be at least in the past, it was focused on public schools and elementary and secondary schools. And the goals of it is to develop a safety plan, is to do a threat assessment, is to look at all the different factors that would go into creating a safe environment within the school. So with that, I'm going to ask Ms. Eide to expand.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Eide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Wigert. My name is Chris Eide. I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Actually, Ms. Ellison was correct in that we're really focusing on K through 12, but we will be looking at public, private, and charter schools. The former Minnesota School Safety Center was originally in my division, and they did work with some of the private schools and then some of the charter schools also. Focus mainly on the preparedness portion, which really is assessing, planning, training, and exercising. We would work in partnership with the Safe and Supportive School Act If that passes, they're creating a school climate center. That's really a lot of the prevention piece of it. And then the school safety center would be dealing with the physical plant and the procedures for the security and the safety of the school. So it would be working with them to give them the resources in the toolkits, templates to develop a school emergency plan, a school violence prevention plan from intruders. It would be training active shooter, multi-hazard emergency planning. It would be working with the fire marshal's office so that when they go in on their inspections and they look at their emergency plan, since we're the emergency planning subject matter experts, we work in concert with them, working with them to make sure that they can work with the communities and do a community-wide exercise, which is really the only way that we know that their plans work.
Senator Weger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe we could meet early next week to talk about some additional assurance of coordination in the E-12 budget division. A few of us are members of that. We're looking at a number of safe school initiatives and, you know, direct aid for that mention was made of the climate center. We have some mandates for emergency drills. There's voluntary things here, and it wasn't clear as to whether private schools would be included or colleges, and maybe we should align our expectations.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we'll be happy to do that.
Great. Anything further?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Senjum.
And you know, I think we all share the goals of school safety, but this sort of tastes like we're trying to centralize emergency preparedness in St. Paul. And I think with that comes some risk. I think as we decentralize and work with county emergency managers and local law enforcement people and fire people, all who live day-to-day in communities, planning and frankly, even exercising, I know we're not going to run into conflicts here, but it just seems to me that we ought to think a little bit about how we approach this from the standpoint of, in my view at least, a more local planning process as opposed to a state planning process imposed upon local communities is a better approach. And maybe it's just a philosophical bent.
Commissioner,
just a comment.
Commissioner.
If you want to respond, that's fine.
Commissioner Dolman.
Mr. Chair.
Sounds like Commissioner does want to respond.
I do. Mr. Chair, Senator Sinjum, I appreciate the comment. I think that probably the way to look at the school safety center as it was previously and the discussions that we've had ongoing since this budget came out is that the school safety center in the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management would be a resource for all of Minnesota emergency managers, schools, first responders to go to so that they can best prepare for the incidents that might be occurring in their communities. And so it wouldn't necessarily be people working in St. Paul doing it for each of the districts or each of the regions. It would be a resource for those. And I can ask Chris to elaborate on that Director Ide, if you have any other comments.
Director Ide.
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, the commissioner is exactly right. We would not go outside our mission that Homeland Security Emergency Management is a coordinating agency. We provide toolkits. We provide resources. We provide for the training. We aren't going to go in and do evaluations. We will provide the toolkits in order for them to work with their local community, work with contractors, whoever they do assessments themselves. We will work with them and provide for the training for them, just like we do now with fire departments and local law enforcement, EMS services, local public health. We would not be going outside of our mission of Homeland Security Emergency Management as a coordinating agency.
And Ms. Chair, and to the witnesses, I'm probably responding a little bit too literally to how this is written in our summary sheet, where five positions to, you know, to provide emergency preparedness, et cetera, et cetera. It sounded to me like we're centralizing this thing, and But I understand your situation, your resource, which is the way I think it ought to be. So, fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Sendrum. Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving on to the rest of the change items, the next one is for replacement of forensic laboratory equipment. We are requesting $125,000 each year for $250,000 from the general fund and $250,000 from the Trunk Highway Fund. The equipment for the Forensic Science Laboratory was purchased when the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension building in St. Paul was built, and that was about 11 years ago. And it's very expensive equipment, and we do have some base budget funding for it, but one piece of equipment could easily take the whole budget, and our maintenance agreements are coming to an end. And again, this is to keep our Forensic Science Laboratory operating as it should be operating. The reason we're asking for Trunk Highway funding and general fund money is that the Trunk Highway Fund is used for both here and in the next item I'm going to talk about for staffing and equipment that supports the DWI testing that we do for people that are stopped by the troopers that control our trunk highways. So we've done analysis in the past in terms of how much of the business of the forensic laboratory is generated by trunk highway through the trunk highway system with state troopers, and how much is generated just regularly with other law enforcement agencies. And so that's why the request is divided up the way it is. It relates directly also to the next item, which is request an increase for two chemists and two toxicologists. I think you're aware of the issues that we've been facing, probably reading it in the news for as a result of the St. Paul Crime Lab situation. And our backlog of drug testing is very significant and increasing, and we need additional staff in order to reduce the turnaround time on the tests that need to be done for the criminal justice system to operate.
So,
questions about this?
What was not mentioned is that in order to provide trunk highway funds for this purpose, a change in state law is necessary, and that was we kind of jumped over that in the previous presentation by Mr. Peterson. But I see, and I was not aware that the effort of a few years ago to kind of get our arms around what we call trunk highway fund leakage, specifically written into state statute, was a prohibition on using trunk highway funds for Bureau of Criminal Apprehension labs. So I'm a little concerned that no one had mentioned that. I kind of figured that out myself a few days ago.
Mr. Chair, traditionally this is the way these items have been funded.
Right.
Not anything new?
Well, I'll call your attention to Minnesota Statutes 161.20 Subdivision 3, which in the A1 amendment members is in the first bill, which is on page 19, starting on 19.9. There's a change to state law to allow for trunk highway fund purposes. I guess it's in the public safety bill too. So, again, I'm just concerned that a change in state law was necessitated in order to do this reach into the trunk highway funds. I'll just note that for the record that I'm concerned. I haven't seen the analysis that shows that this much money is needed and can be allocated to state highway patrol uses of the labs. I'd be interested in that analysis and that data, and how much of this is actually being necessitated by the St. Paul labs. Dysfunctionality, and how much St. Paul is contributing to make up that gap.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we certainly can provide you with further information. However, traditionally, I would just state that as long as I've been around, with the forensic science area has been funded in part by trunk highway funds, and again, the justification was because of the business that was generated, loosely using the term business, by the State Patrol.
Members, it's also in Senate File 671 on page 9, starting on 9.23. The language in question that's being deleted is on 9.26. So I don't know if we've been paying these dollars out of the Trunk Highway Fund illegally, but...
Mr. Chair, I would have to ask for legal research or on that, and also Superintendent Setter is here from the BCA to add some additional information.
I am familiar with the effort, and if folks have been around here for a while, Senator Johnson, Senator Arata, Senator Murphy, all, you know, had a real focus on keeping a keen eye on use of the Trunk Highway Fund, because there are a lot of just kind of reaches into the Trunk Highway Fund by different agencies outside of even the knowledge and purview of the Department of Transportation. You know, and so this was an attempt at significant reform, and they saw at that point specifically to make sure the BCA labs were not used, were not eligible for these funds. And so I need some more conversation. This kind of shows up, no previous conversation, comes as a bit of a surprise. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got an interest in the forensic lab as well, and to follow up on the chair's question about the St. Paul lab, local law enforcement has contacted me. They received notice that certain types of cases were no longer being handled by the BCA forensic lab, particularly of their concern is the trace case analysis. Will this allow you to get through that backlog and re-implement those programs, or is this to continue those that narrower scope and just keep up with where you're at today?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Wade Setter. I'm the superintendent of the BCA. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Pratt, the policy change you're talking about is about 2 weeks ago. We actually about a month and a half ago, we assembled a group of stakeholders, including law enforcement, the County Attorneys Association, some other attorneys that involve city attorneys, to talk about the backlog. Two things that are taking place in our lab in the drug chemistry, and this only deals with two of the drug chemistry chemists that are in this budget. We have seen a significant increase in submissions for drug chemistry and from drug enforcement analyses anyway. And when our budget was prepared last summer, that was before the St. Paul Crime Laboratory was discontinued testing. So we'd submitted these requests through the commissioner's budget process just to deal with that continued growth. Subsequently, since the St. Paul lab has discontinued drug testing, we have gone from a backlog in the drug chemistry section in January of 2012 our turnaround time was 21 days with about 240 cases in backlog. Today, we are at 4.5 months in backlog with over 1,500 cases in that queue, and we are growing at the rate of 150. In other words, we're adding 150 a month and falling behind further. So our lab did an analysis on some of the things we could do in the short term as a temporary policy, and one of the recommendations from our laboratory was discontinue to do trace amount drug testing analysis. Now, this would help us towards that. We've also since engaged in a contract with the St. Paul Police Department, just actually executed it last week, where they will be contracting with us for the appointment of two additional scientists in drug chemistry to help us with this backlog. The challenge for us, to be quite frank with you, is even with four scientists, if we were to get the appropriation to add two under this bill and then two from St. Paul, four scientists, it'll take us 6 months to a year at a minimum to get them up and running. And then that is if we can find experienced scientists, which is a challenge. There's a limited number of folks with the forensic science background and certifications necessary. So we had to do some things. Other things we're doing is we're requiring them to have a court date before they submit any pharmaceuticals for identification to us. We are still doing marijuana cases as long as there's a court date and so forth. But the reality, if we did nothing, by the end of this year, it would be up to a one-year turnaround time for any drug chemistry analysis. And so I have been working significantly with the law enforcement prosecution community. I've got to tell you, from the commissioner's office, through my office, to the lab, to law enforcement, prosecution, none of us are happy about this. But the volume increase is significant, and we're trying to do the best we can.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you. And just trying to get some context around whether or not this will resolve that issue or not, and it sounds like partially.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pratt, it will keep it in abeyance at this point, and we're looking at other strategies. One of the other programs we're actually in the process of developing is a field identification program for preliminary screening of drugs by police officers. That's never been done before in Minnesota. One of the potential outcomes of that that we're hopeful for, that's been demonstrated in other states such as Utah, is reducing submissions because it is a volume issue. I mean, this is a production environment. For example, one scientist can do approximately 300 to 400 analyses in a year in the drug chemistry section. That doesn't seem like a lot, but, of course, being an accredited laboratory, we have to follow the standards that are required under federal and international standards. When you look at 13 to 14 folks in there and take into account for family medical leave, vacations, and so forth, we are just trying to maintain the status quo at this point and trying to keep it from deteriorating to, you know, 8 months to a year, which really impugns the criminal justice system.
Thank you. I appreciate your efforts. I know that's in our area, what I'm hearing, it's a significant public safety concern, and so I appreciate your efforts in trying to get your hands around that.
And we see ourselves as partners, Senator Pratt, in this challenge.
So two questions. One is the St. Paul situation. How long was St. Paul, how long have the St. Paul cases been shifted over to the BCA labs, and was that happening without any reimbursement by the city of St. Paul? How long was that? Is that the circumstance that was occurring, or has St. Paul been paying all along?
Mr. Chairman, this all began last July of 2012, and it's not just the St. Paul Police Lab. St. Paul Police Lab was doing analyses for St. Paul Police, Ramsey County Sheriffs, most of the law enforcement agencies in Ramsey County and Dakota Counties. So when we talk about St. Paul Lab, it's not just one agency. We were picking up a volume for three major urban counties.
And have they paid anything to date for picking
well,
up
they have, Mr. Chair, they did provide us, St. Paul Police Department early on met with us, and they did provide us with some overtime funds to help try and address some of the retest cases that were done as part of the Dakota County challenges that were taking place. They are now, in fact, under contract with us to pay for two scientists. It's about a $200,000 a year contract, roughly.
But that's prospective and not...
Right, moving forward, correct.
All right. And is St. Paul... I thought I read something in the paper that St. Paul is hoping to once again reestablish its lab. Is that in the works? Is that going to happen?
Mr. Chairman, I can tell you just from my discussions with the St. Paul Police Department and Chief Smith, they have hired consultants. They have reevaluated their program. It's my understanding that moving forward, they want to reestablish their fingerprint section, and drug chemistry maybe at some point in the future, but no immediate plans. Recognizing that some of the discussions that have taken place in the legislature on accreditation and meeting the accreditation standards under ASCLAD as one example is very challenging and somewhat expensive. So I know that they're evaluating the future of how expansive their section is in terms of crime laboratories.
Well, don't misunderstand me. We have the similar issue with tort claims that have been paid. This is a MnDOT issue. Out of the Trunk Highway Fund, that's specifically excluded in law, and there's a change of state law. So that's been the practice in violation of state law, so we're making a change. So I want to solve this problem. I want to understand what the appropriate amounts are that can be attributed and allocated to state highway patrol purposes. I also want to understand the implications of this Dakota, Ramsey, and St. Paul lab, St. Paul cases issue. And, clearly they've been kind of offloaded and shifted all this work over to the BCA. Mm-hmm. Arguably, they've been saving money as a consequence of that, and the situation has been created by that circumstance. Is the Trunk Highway Fund picking up for? Are we basically making a gift to mm-hmm. those three entities by doing this reach to the into the Trunk Highway Fund of this amount?
Mr. Chairman, I just as a point of clarification, the $400,000 you see there is actually two scientists in drug chemistry, which is one of our strategies to respond to the St. Paul Crime Laboratory challenges that we're experiencing. The other two is for toxicology, and that is directly related to blood and urine test analysis for DWI enforcement. And one of the things we've seen there is since 2006, the number of submissions our toxicology section is seeing, which is DWI enforcement, has doubled from 6,000 to 12,000 a year or more. And so that is to try and deal with that different increase. It's a separate increase from the drug chemistry. I just want to make that clarification.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate that. Well, we'll have more conversation over the weekend. I'll be in all weekend, so you'll know where to find me. Anything for Senator Senjum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. May I just ask, would it be possible, probably not an idea but
Would it be possible if all the chain of custody issues were resolved and the certifications were in place for the state of Minnesota to privately outsource this to, you know, a fully accredited medical diagnostic laboratory?
Mr. Chair, okay. Senator Senjum, it's interesting. That's an interesting question because as we have moved forward with whether it's drug chemistry or other aspects of our laboratory, finding accredited laboratories in the private sector on a national level, there are some. But I would suggest to you that anybody that's explored the use of them finds them cost prohibitive. Doing the analysis is one component of it, so having the scientists perform the analysis and render a report. But when it comes time to going to court, the costs of bringing a witness to court are extensive, and that's, of course, one of our challenges as well just within greater Minnesota. And it becomes cost prohibitive, is my experience.
So, Mr. Chair, and a lot of the, you know, a lot of the cost then is related to off, you know, the court testifying, things like that, time away from okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, anything further on this, members? Okay, thank you, Deputy Commissioner Allison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next item is a request from the general fund of $699,000 for the biennium for maintenance of LiveScan fingerprinting machines. LiveScan fingerprinting machines allow us to capture fingerprints in a matter of minutes instead of hours. It used to be that you'd roll it on a card and mail it into the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Now, through the LiveScan fingerprint machines that have been placed throughout the state of Minnesota, we can do that in a matter of minutes. There are 177 machines statewide. The state purchased those machines several years ago and placed them around the state of Minnesota with the understanding that we would continue to maintain them. The maintenance agreements for those LiveScan machines are now coming to expire, and so this is a request to continue to maintain those machines so that we can be efficient in collecting fingerprints for the criminal justice system. The next item is a request for $3.5 million for the biennium for the addition of a data analytics system in the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Really, the future of policing is being able to look at disparate pieces of information and put together patterns in order to predict where crime is likely to occur. And this request is to move our state in that direction.
And this was provided in the supplemental.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, this was in the governor's supplemental budget request. The next item is for restoration of grant funding for crime victim assistance. The last biennium, there was a reduction of $1.5 million per year in assistance to for crime victims statewide. This resulted in a lot of loss of services for crime victims, some closing of some programs, and so this is a request to restore those funds to the base prior to that cut. The final item is a transfer to MnDOT from the State Government Special Revenue Fund, the 911 account, as it's known as. Minnesota Department of Transportation maintains the towers throughout the state of Minnesota, and so we do transfer funds to them on a regular basis for maintaining those funds, and this is a request of $1.6 million from that fund to go to Minnesota Department of Transportation for that purpose.
And members, that's jumping ahead on the spreadsheet to line 329 on page 9. You want to look at that.
Mr. Chair, that completes the description of the budget change items.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions, members? Anything further? All right. We need to lay this on the table. All right. So Chair lays Senate File 671 on the table. Thank you, Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner. Senator Champion, mind taking the chair?
I'm sorry?
Could you possibly take the chair?
Oh, I'd be happy to.
we need to
meet. I didn't even see him asking.
See you later.
Thanks.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, we have Senate File 891. And, Mr. Chair, there is an A1 amendment.
All right.
Vote on, even though we're not going to vote this bill out, but just to put it in proper form.
Would you like to
move? I'll move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion on the A1 amendment? This is the author's first amendment, so we will definitely do that. All those in favor, vote aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is the second what we would call a vision bill, and it was prepared with the assistance of many, many of our stakeholders and partners that come from across the state and from every endeavor and every corner and every sector that has a focus and a concern and a connection to transportation. We'll hear a little bit more about the large coalition that's come together to put these ideas on the table. But it's safe to say that it is designed to give us the ability to lay out the need for greater effort in transportation investments and show how we might achieve that goal. We know, of course, from a lot of the hearings and overviews that we had at the outset of this session, at the start of this committee's series of meetings, from the TFAC report, the Itasca Group ROI report that Chair Haig just spoke about, additional report. The TRIP report, yes. I made a note to remind myself of what that was. But we know that the need and the opportunity are extremely substantial in Minnesota. In quick high-level overview, what this bill proposes to do is provide $2.4 billion for state highways, county highways, city and township roads. It proposes to offer $700 million for transit systems statewide, and I'm speaking about over the coming 4 years. And it does that in a few key ways. And I'll just give a very high-level overview. I'm not going to go through the bill section by section, but I've kept track of where these do show up in the A1 amendment if you need that. But it raises the state gas tax by 5 cents per gallon starting in 2013 or in fiscal year 2013. That raises about $150 million. And then it provides for some bonding, which I'll describe, and some debt service on that bonding, similar to what we have now with a surcharge that'll escalate over the coming 3 years of 1.5 cents per gallon. It provides dedicated revenue through the license tab fees by increasing the tax rate from 1.25% to 1.375%, and the flat tax paid by all vehicle owners, and that raises about $95 million. It extends the state sales tax to automobile parts and services and dedicates that revenue across a variety of purposes. And that raises about $174.6 million. For transit and other metropolitan purposes, it increases the current quarter-cent metropolitan area transportation sales tax to by a half cent to three quarters, and it distributes that across a number of transportation purposes. Then it has a number of local options that we've had some discussion about already in this committee. The wheelage tax, the local option sales tax in greater Minnesota at the county level, street improvement districts at the municipal level. It does have this is going back now to the state highway fund, a fine for paying license tab fees late. We were going to hear that bill last week. It has some logistical issues, but that proposal is in this bill. It does exempt purchases made by public agencies for transportation purposes from the sales tax, a goal that we've all had for quite a while, have been unable to fund because that's a hit to the general fund. But when you think about it, why do we do that? Because we're paying for these street improvements with the trunk highway fund, and then we're kind of yanking it back into the general fund with the sales tax that we pay when we're doing these transportation efforts. And then there are some loopholes in existing law related to the payment of the motor vehicle sales tax, including gifts between individuals, except for, of course, if they're related, but can't just simply give a car to someone in order to escape paying the motor vehicle sales tax. Vehicles purchased outside the state, again, an effort to elude and escape the motor vehicle sales tax. And then the flat fee for collector vehicles, which hasn't been increased for quite some time, is raised just a little bit. The bonding program that I mentioned earlier would authorize a total of $800 million in bonding in trunk highway bonds, with $200 million authorized each year for the coming 4 years. And that would be split $100 million and $100 million into the Transportation Economic Development Fund and into the SIMS, the Corridor Investment Management Strategy. Members, I think it is a really interesting package of ideas that really is worthy of consideration and discussion. With that, I'll suspend and introduce Margaret Donahoe, who is helping spearhead this coalition and the effort around this proposal.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Donahue, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Margaret Donahoe. I'm the director of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. I want to begin by thanking Senator Dibble for introducing this legislation and having this discussion about the need for an increase in transportation funding statewide. We do have a very strong and growing coalition of organizations, and I've provided some information that hopefully you have in your packets about the membership of the alliance. It does include local governments, private companies that are involved in transportation, labor unions, transit systems, and other advocates for transportation. So it's a very diverse and statewide coalition of groups that represent thousands of Minnesotans who all understand the importance of taking care of our transportation system. We really see this as a jobs bill. We know that the investment in transportation will not only create jobs immediately in construction and design work, but it builds the infrastructure that our businesses need to move products and move people. And as you heard earlier, it's a consideration when businesses are looking at whether or not to locate in Minnesota or to expand in Minnesota. They want to know what kind of transportation system there is, and that includes transit. It also includes things like access to a four-lane highway or access to an airport in order to ship products. And so those are very big considerations. If we want to expand our economy, we need to be investing in our transportation system. According to the U.S. Census Bureau data, construction and maintenance of transportation supports the equivalent of 70,241 full-time jobs in Minnesota. So it's a big part of our economy. These employees earn a total annual payroll of over $3 billion and contribute an estimated $268 million in state and federal payroll taxes. But the future is not looking very bright. So one of the things that I've included for you in your packets is this chart that shows MnDOT's construction program. And as you can see, in the coming years, while the announcement for this year's construction season sounds very positive, in the next few years, construction on the state highway system is projected to fall off pretty dramatically. And that means a significant loss of jobs. It also means that a number of important highway and bridge projects will not be able to be completed because the funding is not available. And a lot of this has to do with borrowing. We borrowed federal funds that have to be paid back. We used trunk highway bonds that are now being spent. And so without additional revenue, this is the future that we are living into. The other piece of information that should be in your packets is a list of bills that have been introduced this session for transportation projects. And while the legislature typically does not earmark for specific projects, I think what this shows is the real need and real demand that's out there for specific highway and bridge and transit projects, that legislators understand the importance of these projects, want to see these projects built. The request is for a little over $1.4 billion in funding. For many of these projects, that would not complete the construction of those projects. The construction cost is closer to about $3 billion. for all of these projects on the list. Some of the money is simply for design work, but that money is not available. So all the projects on this list simply will not get built anytime in the near future unless there is some additional revenue for both highways and transit. You've heard all the reports about the needs. I think one of the numbers that's really important that the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee came up with is the cost just to maintain the system that we have today. So on the state highway system, we're short $5 billion over the next 20 years just to maintain the system in the condition that it's in today. And this is a very important state asset, and we think it is critical for the state to maintain and preserve this asset so that it's there for future generations. The bill before you largely follows the recommendations of the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee. So that group also recommended increasing the gas tax, the license tab fees, dedicating the sales tax on leased vehicles to transportation, increasing the metro area sales tax, authorizing local governments to have tools like the wheelage tax and the street improvement district. The one thing that this bill does add is the extension of the sales tax to auto parts and services. That was originally part of the governor's proposal to extend the sales tax, and dedicating that to transportation, which is actually not a new idea. It was part of the study board, Transportation Study Board recommendations back in 1990. So there are a number of revenue sources in this bill, and we think it's important to really emphasize that that's what it takes to make progress on our transportation system. There's no single revenue source that meets the needs that can be distributed statewide that will fund both highways and transit. We need a package. We need a package that is balanced, and we need a package that is significant enough to really make a difference in getting a lot of these kinds of projects done. As you can see, the dollar amounts are high on some of these projects, so it does take a significant amount of revenue. And I just want to say one thing about the gas tax. We're very, very supportive of increasing the gas tax. And just to kind of put things in context, as you heard, a 5-cent increase in the gas tax generates about $150 million a year. And, of course, according to the Constitution, that has to be divided, 62% to MnDOT. So that's about $88 million a year for all the state highways, 29% to counties, so that's about $41 million for all 87 counties. And that's about 9% goes to municipal state aid cities, so that's about $13 million for all municipal state aid streets. So when you divide it all up statewide, it does not provide a huge amount of money. And so we think it is important to leverage additional trunk highway bonds and to have multiple revenue sources and to look for revenue sources that will grow in the future. Because the projections for the gas tax are that it will decline in the future. In fact, between the November 2012 forecast and the February 2013 forecast, the projections for fuel tax have for the next 4 years, so from 2014 to 2017, those projections have gone down by $97 million. So the revenues are not going in the right direction, and we need to make sure that we're also looking for stable funding for our transportation system going into the future. Some states are looking at a sales tax on fuel. Most notably, the state of Virginia actually replaced their excise tax with a sales tax on fuel and received a lot of praise from Moody's rating agency for doing that because the condition of our highway system in states can affect your bond rating. So that is another consideration that we just hope that you will be thinking about as you put together a transportation funding package. So thank you very much, and if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer anything.
Thank you, first of all, for your testimony. Any questions of the testifier? If not, we will go on. Is it okay that we go down the list?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Why don't we just go down the list?
Okay. Tim Warkey from the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota.
Diane, go first.
Okay. All right. I guess we're going to have Diane go first.
Thank you. And if you identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am the owner and president of Holte Contracting. I am a certified DBE, which is a disadvantaged business enterprise that performs full-depth asphalt reclamation on Minnesota roadways. Thank you for listening to what I have to say. I will try to be respectful of your time by using the 3B system or format in my testimony. Be brief, be brilliant, and be gone. My company, Holte Contracting, is a small woman-owned business that employs approximately 12 people. I have just started to recover from the funding shortfalls of the recession that darn near put my business out of business. With a projected decrease in transportation funding, I will not risk buying that new equipment or hiring the new employees that I need to expand a new division for my business, of which I have spent an enormous amount of time and research in developing. I ask you to support Senate File 891 and give small businesses like mine a reason to buy that new equipment, to hire those new employees, and to contribute to the economic growth of the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Holte. It's so good to see you.
Yes.
Any questions for the testifier? If none, thanks again for your testimony.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good morning. My name is Tim Workey. I represent the Associated General Contractors. We're a construction trade association, some 450 members of our organization. Both large and small, Ms. Holte is one of our board members as well, and she represents the smaller aspect of our organization. But over 90% of our contractors employ fewer than 20 persons. So we do represent that small business component. I wanted to talk to a couple elements of the proposal in front of you today, and you'll hear these constant themes, I believe, with the folks testifying, so I won't dwell on them to a great extent. But we support what is in front of you in this package today from AGC's perspective, because it's a balanced package that we believe addresses the modes equally and provides a balanced revenue stream for the modes proportionately. We also would echo what Ms. Donahoe said, that failure to act this legislative session on transportation funding is going to have significant consequences. I think the handout that she gave you illustrates well the infrastructure cliff that is facing Minnesota should we not choose to act this year, and that action has consequences, that failure to invest in that infrastructure is not going to mean that the problems go away. It just means that they get more expensive. One of the key aspects I'd like to leave with you is that there is no better time than right now to build in construction. There are a number of reasons for that, mainly and principally that the construction marketplace is recovering from a depression situation in the tough economy that we've all faced, but it has hit construction especially hard. But that's been reflected in very competitive pricing that you're seeing in bids with not only local governments, but with MnDOT as well. Cost of construction inputs are generally stable right now. Things like concrete and steel, even fuel, have remained stable. And that allows for better pricing and more predictable pricing. Our skilled construction workforce in Minnesota is a true benefit and brings true value to Minnesota construction in that we have a very good and very skilled and very safe and efficient workforce in Minnesota, and a lot of those folks are waiting to go back to work in this marketplace. Lastly, the cost of money is at a historic all-time low. Borrowing is very economical right now, and that should be taken into consideration as well. You all know the effect of job creation and infrastructure investment. I just wanted to ring that bell for you as well, that there are multiple studies that show that investing in infrastructure does create jobs. immediate on-site construction jobs than the jobs that are what are called indirect and then what are also called induced jobs, but a significant benefit to the economy. Lastly, I just want to leave you with a thought about balance as it relates to transportation investment as you consider this in the final days or final weeks of the session here. It's important from the contractor's perspective that any package that comes from the legislature this year be a balanced package. Modally, again, highways and transit, but also in the relative proportionate distribution of those revenues. We've seen in this body the history of having an unbalanced package does not lead to success. We have worked together with our partners in transit and other modes successfully in order to have some great successes in recent years, and we would encourage you to consider that. And finally, I want to echo what Ms. Donahoe said about the gas tax and its declining strength as a principal revenue source for highways. This package contains multiple revenue streams, which we believe is a good approach. The reliance of the past on the gas tax and its declining viability is something that is not going to serve us going into the future, in that we think that the multiple revenue approach is a good way to start thinking about this. So with that, I'll suspend my comments and take any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will now, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, to go to Abby Burdick and John Well. And seeing that Chivalry's not dead, we'll have the lady go first. And if you'll introduce yourself for the record, that'd be great.
I might not have much time.
I see.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, committee members. My name is Abby Breideck with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I think many of the high points of this bill and the reason for its composition have been adequately explained, well explained by the previous testifiers. I would like the committee to know that the Association of Minnesota Counties has identified transportation funding as a priority this year, and we're working on passing resolutions at the board level. And so many of you in the upcoming week will hear from us about your local governments passing these resolutions. As I said, many good comments were already made, but one thing I'd like to impress, and I think this message is getting across, is many people look at this, the size of this bill, and balk at it and think, are surprised by the size of it. But, you know, transportation, as many of you know, is a very capital-intensive industry. And while this seems like a large package, this one on the table would barely allow the counties to preserve their systems in current, as they currently are. So I just want to leave you with that thought, and I'll defer to John Welly, who is one of our county engineers from Aiken.
Thank you. Mr. Welly, please identify yourself for the record and go forward with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is John Welly. As Abby said, I am the Aiken County engineer, and I also sit here today as a representative of the Minnesota County Engineers Association. I serve as secretary of that association. For those of you that aren't familiar with the County Engineers Association, we're made up of the 87 county engineers from every county in the state. Collectively, we maintain over 34,000 miles of county, state, aid highway, and county roads in the state. That represents about 25% of all the public road miles in the state of Minnesota. Over 30% of the vehicle miles traveled in the state of Minnesota are traveled on our highway. So we are a significant player in the statewide transportation surface system. The mission of the County Engineers Association is to promote the safe, reliable, efficient movement of goods and people throughout the state, to allow our communities statewide to be economically competitive, and to enhance the quality of life for the communities that our system serves. To accomplish this, our association, through our legislative platform, supports long-term sustainable increases in existing transportation revenue sources such as the gas tax, motor vehicle registration fees. You've heard you've heard today already, and I'll talk further about the gap that currently exists between highway construction and maintenance needs and the dedicated funding that currently exists to meet those needs. Senate File 891 will provide over $330 million for counties per year when fully implemented. Now, this money will be used by counties to deliver construction projects like the list that you have before you. Those projects include a variety of types of projects in the urban areas. They include capacity improvements on urban highways. In the more rural areas, they include structural capacity improvements to carry heavier loads, like I said, especially in the rural areas. They include safety projects to address safety concerns on our local highway systems. They will fund bridge replacement projects for deficient bridges. And finally, they'll fund overlay type of projects to provide smoother surfaces for our roads, many of which are in very poor condition. Another thing, another aspect that often doesn't get talked about that I wanted to talk about a little bit here is the maintenance aspect of it, because a significant portion of the money that would be generated for use by counties will be used to maintain our existing system. And when I talk about maintenance, I'm not only talking about the maintenance type of projects, but also things like snow and ice removal, pavement striping, shouldering, crack sealing, seal coating, vegetation management. All of those things cost a lot of money. And what we've all seen as rural counties, in rural and metro counties, in the past years is that we are having to subsidize maintenance of our state aid highway system with local property tax dollars. And the reason for that is because the maintenance gap exists on our systems. It's difficult not to do maintenance. It's difficult to defer maintenance once you've built the system. You've committed to maintaining it, and when the dedicated sources aren't there, for many rural counties like mine, our only option is to raise property taxes. And I can tell you that in Aiken County, we spend over $500,000 annually just maintaining our county state aid highway system. That's how short we are of dedicated transportation funding. That doesn't sound like a lot of money, but that's a significant amount of money when you look at our overall tax levy. The County Engineers Association also supports providing authority for counties to adopt a wheelage tax and local option sales taxes, as have been discussed. These will give counties further options to meet our transportation needs. As you know, the bill provides these, so we are in support of that. The County Engineers Association supports alternate sources of funding, like the ones that are included in the bill for the expanded vehicle repair sales tax that would be dedicated to transportation. We realize that, as it's been stated here several times, the gas tax is a declining revenue source, and we need to look at other funding sources that are going to be stable into the future. And finally, the county engineers support an exemption for counties from state sales tax. Collectively, this amounts to tens of millions of dollars every year that are dollars that were either collected from dedicated highway funds through the state or levied specifically for road and bridge purposes at the county level. All of those monies are paid to the state general fund. They take away from being able to use those funds on highway-related type of things, and it also has the property tax implication once again. So in summary, the county engineers strongly support Senate File 891. It will provide much-needed resources to meet our ever-increasing demands of our highway systems. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for your attention. If there's any questions, I could stand at those for those at this time. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions of either testifier? Because I know I didn't ask that question after Ms. Burdick's testimony. Any questions of either testifier? Seeing none, thank you so very much for your testimony. And before our next testifiers come, I'm going to ask you, in the interest of time, if you would try to refrain from repeating some of the testimony that has already been provided, just so that we can move forward. And with that being said, Mr. Randy Gerdes?
Correct.
I got it right. Thank you. And then Kent Sullum? And if you'd be so kind as to identify yourself for the record, and let's proceed forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Randy Gertis. I'm the CEO of SRF Consulting Group. We're a Minneapolis-based transportation planning and engineering firm, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of the American Council of Engineering Companies, or ACEC. And I want to thank the Aiken County engineer for doing such a good job of presenting the information to you today. The engineers need to be here in front of you and speak to you more often than we do about the obstacles that we face out there in developing and maintaining our transportation system. our clients include MnDOT, counties like John, cities, and the private sector. And by way of explanation, generations of the engineers before us planned and designed and built the transportation system that we have today. Unfortunately, the lack of sufficient funding and innovation and innovative efforts on it by our generation have been unable to adequately maintain and replace and expand the system that we have. And this lack of investment has resulted in unsafe facilities that are highly congested and that are rapidly deteriorating, and the engineers understand this as well as anybody because we have to try to work with this on a day-to-day basis. We have been actively engaged, working very hard to develop innovative solutions that provide temporary fixes to many of our long-term transportation problems. The engineers have been doing a remarkable job of getting the most of what they have to work with, but we have to face facts. We've fallen very far behind, and we can no longer solve our problems with the funding levels that are currently available to us. Until 2008, the gas tax in Minnesota had not been increased since 1988. And during those 20 years, inflation seriously eroded the buying power of our transportation dollars, and while the cost of materials and labor substantially increased. In 2008, as Ms. Donahoe pointed out, a broad coalition of transportation stakeholders succeeded in gaining an increase to the gas tax and implementing other financing mechanisms. I think we made it clear at that time that that would not be sufficient to address the needs that we saw in front of us, and that's one of the reasons we are back today. Much of that anticipated revenue was not realized due to the severe economic downturn, and we're still feeling the consequences of that today. Now, failure to act, in our opinion, is not an option. Current estimates for needed transportation funding indicate shortfalls in the billions of dollars over the next 20 years just to maintain what we have. I think that's an extremely important fact to point out. We are not generating even enough revenue to maintain what we have already constructed and keep it operational, much less do anything else. I can't emphasize that enough. We have 1 million more residents that are expected to move to Minnesota in the next 20 years, placing a significant demand on our transportation system. Our transportation system supports Minnesota's economy by providing efficient freight movement, one of the largest components of a healthy economy. An efficient multimodal transportation system attracts new businesses to our state, creating new jobs. This funding, as you have heard, provides tax relief to local governments that have had to increasingly rely on the property tax to maintain our roads and bridges. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'll just tell you that, again, we deal with this as engineers on a day-to-day basis, and we need more revenue to do what is right for the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, thank you so much. All right. Introduce yourselves for the record, and we can go forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sewell. I'm general counsel with the Minnesota Association of Townships. In the interest of time, Mr. Vanosik and I are just going to do a very quick tag team, which will take two people off your list. I'll let him begin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Rob Vanosik on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Townships. And want to let the committee know townships, as you have heard from us before, are responsible for a good 55,000 miles of roads and 6,000 bridges across the state. Road and bridge expenses are the number one cost for townships providing services to their residents, and this bill is only a portion of the increased funding necessary to meet demands in our system. A comprehensive statewide transportation bill equals property tax relief for our residents, and we thank the chair for bringing this bill forward. Cars, trucks are not paying for the roads themselves. Property taxes are carrying road expenses at a greater rate each and every year. And actually, that is percentage of the amount invested in roads and bridges is closer to 100% of the coming from property taxes than just a majority. The Township Association does support this bill. We are spending, again, 25% more on roads and bridges in aggregate across the state than we were just 5 years ago. The Highway Users Tax Distribution Fund isn't charging the users enough to pay for roads and bridges. Well, we continue to add more bridges to the state master bridge replacement list than we are taking off. While the Township Association is not opposed to transit in the metro area funded by the metro area, we do support a comprehensive package that includes funding for roads and bridges, but would oppose a transit-only package. We look forward to working with this committee and with each of you to implore on the remainder of your colleagues the importance of investing in a core government function, simply maintaining the transportation infrastructure that we have in the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Mr. Chair, if I may just add a few concluding comments. As Mr. Vanosik indicated, you know, we are the largest single road authority in the state, as well as the single largest bridge authority, but it's frequently a misperception that our roads are strictly local roads and therefore not in need of the state funding. But it's important to remember that it's the local roads that are providing access to get product to market. It's our town roads that are probably the number one use for recreational services around the state, and it is an important cog in the overall transportation system and economy of the state. I'd also simply point out that the need for the comprehensive package, if you start pulling out any one part of the package, somebody suffers. And for us, that would be the loss of the gas tax. Out of all the other funding formulas, you've heard the gas tax is a declining source. It's not enough for the state. But it's the one piece that is constitutionally dedicated and actually literally trickles down to the town level, where many of the other funding sources does not reach the local. So we need to keep it as a comprehensive package so that each road authority unit for our respective road miles has adequate funding. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, thank you so very much. We will now go to Russell Hess from the Labor's District Council of Minnesota and North Dakota, Jason George from the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 49. And when you're ready to proceed, please introduce yourself for the record, and we welcome your testimony.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. My name is Jason George. I'm the Legislative Director with the Operating Engineers Local 49. Just a few brief comments. I think some folks have talked about jobs. I want to really get into detail with you about that. This is a critical piece to this bill. I want to thank Senator Dibble for bringing this forward because this is a huge jobs bill. I don't know how many people are aware of this. We don't do a good enough job maybe talking about it, but from 2005 to 2011, the state lost 52,000 construction jobs. That's not, that's the equivalent, by the way, of probably three or four Fortune 500 companies just folding. So when we talk about the need for jobs in this industry, it's absolutely critical, and we need to do more to create funding to create those jobs. The current funding isn't cutting it. There's no question. To give you an idea about just for our specific trade, in 2005 we had about a little over 13,000 heavy equipment operators in our union alone. In 2010, at the worst of the depression, we had 10,000. That's 3,000 highly skilled heavy equipment operators that left Minnesota. Now, I can tell you that those folks are highly intelligent. They're highly skilled. Those skills are in high demand. And they watch very closely what happens in states and who's funding and infrastructure, who's not. they will go, and they are going, they have gone, they've left. They've gone to where people are investing in roads and bridges and transit. And we're not going to get them back here until we start doing the same. So, you know, the other thing I would point out is of the people, of the members that we had left, and it is starting to grow a little bit. We've recovered a little bit in the last couple of years due to some of the things that this legislature and the governor have done. But it's nowhere near what it needs to be. And the people that have remained of our membership, 3,000 of those Minnesotans are working in North Dakota right now, building roads, bridges in North Dakota. To me, that's a shame. We have 3,000 highly skilled, ready-to-work operating engineers building infrastructure in our fellow competitor to our neighbor state. My plea to you is to bring them home. Let's build stuff here. And I hope that we'll do that. Senator Dibble's bill does that. I really can't thank you enough for stepping up, and it's a difficult thing to do, to put together a big comprehensive package, which is what is needed to bring those folks home. And Senator Dibble has done that, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next testify.
My name is Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Russell Hess, and I work for the members of the Laborers District Council of Minnesota and North Dakota. We represent 10,000 skilled construction laborers who live and work all across Minnesota. I like to say, when people ask, sometimes people have a little bit of confusion about what the laborers, they get confused with the labor and laborers union. What we do, I say, when you drive through a highway project and you see those guys driving the equipment, those are Jason's operators. When you see everybody down in the dirt getting dirty in the hot sun or in the trench getting muddy, those are laborers. That's the first time I've got to laugh at one of these committees on that line. I'm glad that it actually works. Today I want to speak in favor of a comprehensive bill, a transportation bill that strengthens our roads, bridges, and transit systems, thereby allowing for new economic growth, but more importantly to our members, will provide thousands of family-supporting careers all over Minnesota. That's the beauty of transportation, is that we need roads and bridges and transit everywhere in Minnesota. We all have a stake in this. These careers provide good health insurance for over 23,000 Minnesotans, livable wages, and secure retirements. For us, the numbers cannot be starker. Work hours for our members, as Jason had mentioned, peaked for us in 2006 with about 4,700,000 work hours in heavy and highway construction. That's about 4,000 jobs. By 2009, we'd reached the bottom, where we'd lost 1,300 of those 3,000 jobs. Through three quarters of 2012, we don't have the numbers for the last quarter of 2012, we're still off that peak by 700 jobs. We're really concerned that with work hours so low, Minnesota is going to be faced with a real, what I like to call, a brawn and brain drain as people leave the industry and new people take a look and say, this isn't a full-time career for me because there's not enough hours of work. New people aren't going to come in. We're already struggling to get people interested in construction, which ultimately, as skilled, trained workers leave the industry and new people don't come in, raises the cost of construction and delays a solution to the problem even longer as we have to train a new group. So I'm going to leave it right there. I think we've covered it between Jason and I. So, again, I'd like to thank you guys for taking up a comprehensive bill. We'll be out there supporting it.
Thank you again for your testimony. Any questions of the testifiers? Seeing none, thank you so much for your testimony. Ms. Kim from MIMBES, Mayor Jim Hovland from Edina. And again, Chivalry is not dead, so I would love for Ms. Kim to proceed first.
Mr. Chair.
Introduce yourself for the record, please.
I will do that. Mr. Chair and the members of the committees, thank you so much for your time. I kind of cut my speech of 3 minutes, but I'm just going to proceed what I would like to say. My name is Hyun Kim, and I'm the owner of Minister Best Incorporated. It is a small, minority-owned company. We call it DBE and TGB company. Our company provides project oversight services, specializing in schedule management and training on transportation projects. I'm here as a small business owner, and I want to give you my small perspective as to why transportation investment is important to us. Our company's success, if we have a little, is a shining example of how investment in transportation is not only important to our state's infrastructure, but to the state business community. We are again small, minority-owned DB company, yet working with MnDOT's Mentor Protege program, MnBest has been able to increase its knowledge base and experience to become a recognized asset in our field. This MnDOT-sponsored program has been an important influence in the evolution of our company. And through our training services, we have been able to give other state contractors and the state skill set to work with MnDOT as well. I'm going to cut some of the stuff here. So currently, MnBest is working closely with MnDOT on an exciting project aimed at increasing efficiency in project management and scheduling on department-wide base. This initiative is aimed at improving how the department manages its projects and resources. This is an example of what we have observed as MnDOT's continued commitment to efficiency and accountability. In short, we think that state's transportation dollars are being spent wisely, and increased funding will show a very good return on investment. All of this is to say is that I believe that increased transportation dollars would be a wise investment for our state. The money will be spent effectively. It will greatly improve our transportation infrastructure, and it will create jobs, and it will help support the state's business community. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Mayor?
Chair, thank you. Committee members, Senator, my name is Jim Hovland. I'm the mayor of Edina. I'm also co-chair of the Regional Council of Mayors, and I appear here today on behalf of Metro Cities, which is an organization of over 80 municipalities in the metropolitan area, testifying in behalf of this real balanced approach to transportation funding in the state of Minnesota. We like the fact that it looks at rural interests, it looks at metro interests, it looks at roads, bridges, and transit, all of those things extraordinarily important. You know, I think it was a couple of years ago, you and I were at a luncheon at the University of Minnesota Center for Transportation Studies. I remember sitting there, we had a guy from the retired deputy commissioner from the Federal Highway Administration. He said, in the United States, our ace in the hole used to be our transportation system. We could move people and goods faster than anybody in the world. We don't have that advantage anymore. We don't want that to happen to our state. What's happening to our country. And one of the things I think that we need to worry about, and you think about trying to give you something else to think about other than all the important things you've heard today, but when you think about reliance on federal funds, it used to be until about 1993 that the feds were taking the laboring oar here, that they were leading the way on transportation funding. But there hasn't been an increase in the gas tax, federal gas tax, since 1993. And now it's estimated that the current shortfall from federal funding to the states is about $30 billion a year. And except for about that $49 billion that we saw pass through to the states from the American Recovery and Reconstruction Act, the ARRA, the stimulus funds, I don't think we can expect much in the future. You know, here we used to be on a six-year plan of reauthorization with federal highway trust funds coming to the states. We had some predictability. Now we're on a two-year cycle. Folks here are still trying to figure out what MAP 21 means, and I think you've heard that from MnDOT, and the chair had some good information this morning, I thought. So we got to take care of ourselves is what it boils down to. And I've heard so many people testify this morning from so many different walks of life, whether they're government, private sector, nonprofits, This is going to be a tough decision for you guys to think about going to the main part of the legislature and say, we need to raise some new money here. But you should know when you go there that everybody in the state has your backside. Every city in the metro has your backside. Every city involved in the League of Minnesota Cities has your backside. Every county has your backside. Everybody's going to be looking to you for leadership here, because I think we all want to stand for prosperity. We all want to stand for economic competitiveness. We all want to stand for quality of life. We all want to stand for safety. And you guys can lead the way on that. You can, in this Senate committee, you can lead the way by coming up with some new sources of funding for transportation, because it's sorely needed. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony.
Can I just add one more? I would like to say that I'm originally from South Korea, and South Korea was torn by war in 1950s. And as of last year, they did trade over $1 trillion a year. And South Korea is two-thirds of the size of Minnesota. They might be cracked down by North Korea, who knows. But how I think the success that they're bringing to $1 trillion a year, the international trade they do, and their ninth economic engine in the world, is because of how they built their infrastructure. It is unbelievable when I go there to compare with what we have here and what they have. Of course, there's some differences, but I really wish that our country, I'm so proud of being an American, and I really wish that a Minnesotan, that's why my company is Minnesota Best, and I really wish that we really focusing on transportation to make our economic engine move and go forward. Thank you.
Thank you so very much for your testimony. Any questions of the testifiers? Seeing none, thank you so very much for your testimony. Shar Knutson from Minnesota AFL-CIO, Jacob Milner from Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association. Thank you, and you may begin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Shar Knutson, and I'm president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO. The AFL-CIO is a labor federation of more than 1,000 affiliated local unions who collectively represent more than 300,000 working Minnesotans all across the state. And I have also served alongside on TFAC. Sorry. Very quickly, for Minnesota to remain economically competitive in today's economy and also maintain the kind of quality of life that we so love, it's vital that we have a strong transportation system that includes roads, bridges, and transit. A modern transportation infrastructure means goods will get to market more quickly and workers will get to their jobs faster and safer. As we've heard, we know that there have not been long-term investments for the last number of years. And it's because of that investment has only made a small dent in our state's growing transportation needs. And that's why we're here today. I'm here today on behalf of Minnesota's labor movement, asking you to strongly renew your commitment to investing in roads, bridges, and transit. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Mr. Milner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jacob Milner, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Auto Dealer Association. I just wanted to express a few concerns about a number of the provisions in this bill, and I realize I'm the first person to do that today. So while we appreciate the effort to look at this comprehensively, I have four issues I'd like to speak about briefly. First, increasing the motor vehicle, the tax from $10 to $20, and increasing the license tab and registration fees. We do have some concerns about that because Minnesota drivers are already paying significantly more to register and tab their cars than drivers in our surrounding states. Just a quick example, a 2012 Ford Fusion at $21,000 costs a Minnesotan $314 to register, where it costs a driver in Wisconsin about $144 and in South Dakota merely $51. So I just want that to be kept in mind as we move forward. Secondly, on the issue of taxing vehicle repairs and maintenance, as you know, this is not currently taxed. It was originally in the part of the governor's budget. We view this mostly as a misery tax on people who have had the unfortunate experience to have their car need a repair. Aftermarket add-ons are currently taxed, so we view that as an opportunity here for the state to benefit from citizens' misfortune. But we also have a more serious concern here dealing with the administration of such a tax, should this be part of the package moving forward. Currently, many car buyers purchase warranties and service contracts as part of the overall purchase when they buy the car, and this is included in the monthly payment on their vehicle. And this is taxed at the MVEST rate under Section 297B in current statute. The way this bill is currently written, it would tax the money under 297A, which is the general money, and we need to be ensure, our dealers need to be able to ensure that if this proposal moves forward, that we can administer this tax in the correct manner. So that is an administrative issue we have on that. And then two other issues here, which have been touched on, I know, in this committee, and you've heard before, so I'll be very brief, is the section dealing with the street improvement fees. We just believe that this is an end run around the requirements to protect property owners under special assessment laws currently. The bill language, as you know, and I'll be brief, requires no requirement that a property owner actually benefits from the improvement to their the improvement. There's no caps on these, and there's no requirement to get voter approval. These rates can be varying between different classifications of property and can go on for 20 years. As you know, there's a broad coalition working on this right now, and we've been in touch with Senator Carlson on this, and we just believe there's several potential unintended consequences on that. And lastly, on the wheelage, also I've testified on that in this committee, and my understanding is that there will be a flat rate at some point, and our big concern on that is that the potential for a varying fee across 87 counties would be very hard for our dealers to administer when selling a vehicle. So it would be preferable, if that's the direction the committee chooses to go, that there just be a flat local option. And with that, that's my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Any questions of the testifiers? If none, thank you so much for your testimony. Now, Jeannie Fox from Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, John Hausladen. From the Trucking Association. And once you're prepared, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be very brief because my comments are limited only to one very small section, Section 5 of Article 5, Municipal Street Improvement Districts. And on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, our concern on this specific piece is that basically it would require tax-exempt organizations to pay what we see as essentially a property tax. I, too, have had some conversations with Senator Carlson, who has specific interest in this language. There may be some remedies. A little bit on the history, Article 10 of the Constitution on taxation exempts public institutions, colleges and universities, churches and institutions of purely public charity from the property tax. And in 2009, the legislature, for the first time, codified the definition of institution of purely public charity. So I'm speaking specifically to that realm, and we feel like this particular small piece of the bill would undermine that exemption. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks by just saying, again, our concern as the Council of Nonprofits and our 2,000 members is only specific to Section 5. Be interested in maybe given all the support that's been demonstrated, maybe the author would consider removing that one controversial piece of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hausladen.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Hausladen, president of the Minnesota Trucking Association. It's a pleasure to be here today. We represent over 720 motor carriers and their allied vendors. Minnesota trucking companies care very deeply about Minnesota's roads and bridges. And I do want to thank the committee and the author for, you know, tackling an important topic that is really our lifeblood and the lifeblood of the economy. So thanks for staying here in this long committee hearing here today. And I want to stress that the trucking industry has always paid its fair share. It's willing to continue to pay its fair share. And we do come to this as payers then, and as users, and as folks who have to figure out what we can absorb and what we can pass on. So we have some very definite ideas about what we think is the best way to collect those funds. These opinions really stem from the fact that, if you think about it, trucking companies are largely small businesses on wheels. Most trucking companies in the state have 20 or fewer trucks. A lot of them are family-owned. And freight, probably you don't know this, freight quotes are typically calculated in cents per mile. So we really are a business that counts pennies, and pennies make a difference. And when you're a small business with a 2 or 3% margin, pennies matter. So we feel that transportation funding mechanisms should be based on five principles. As you wade through this and try and figure out what's in and what's out, I would offer these for your consideration. First, we think good mechanisms are scalable, meaning you can increase them as the need increases. Secondly, that they're predictable, that you can know in advance before you start your trip what it's going to cost, and it won't change halfway through. We think that they're transparent. The payer knows exactly what they're paying, and they know exactly where it goes. We think that there should be efficiency, meaning that you collect all the money you're supposed to, there's no evasion, and that you spend as little as possible on administering it and putting it into infrastructure. And lastly, that these mechanisms are accountable. The rates and those who set them are subject to a vote of the people. So those are our principles. So let me just address just three elements of Senate File 891, fuel tax, wheelage tax, and street utility fees, just very briefly. We do believe that Minnesota's current system of fuel taxes, vehicle registration fees, and vehicle sales taxes meet each of these principles. And for that reason, we believe that they should continue as the basis of funding our road and bridge system. So those pieces we like. Conversely, we feel strongly that the alternative funding mechanisms contained in the bill, which I addressed, fall short on several of these key principles. So first, wheelage taxes. I know the committee has heard a lot before, but just again to bring the trucking perspective, we're different because of how we register our vehicles, and we have a choice of what county and what state to register them in. So take an example of a trucking company with a fleet of 100 trucks that's in a county that chooses to levy the $20 fee. Let's say it's $20. They'd pay $2,000, whereas the county next door could choose not to levy the fee, and it would be zero. So you have a great difference there. And additionally, national fleets have the opportunity to register their trucks through the International Registration Plan, or the IRP, in any state that they have an established place of business. So under this program, a company could garage their trucks in Minnesota but have them registered through Illinois. So the practical impact is you send the bill to where the, you know, the bill is paid, where they're registered. So in this case, they'd never see a bill for a wheelage tax since their trucks are legally registered elsewhere. But a carrier who base plates their fleet in Minnesota, meaning they register here and they garage here, they're going to see the bill and they will be charged. Now, I know that the chair and author has talked about needing to clear some of this up, so we do appreciate that. And, you know, this is actually a reality for some carriers already. We have carriers in the same county, Dakota County, some paying, some not. And so there's a competitive difference. And if you're located on a border and you have fleets in two states, again, you have the option of where you're going to place it. And it's not always just the tax the county loses, but all the ancillary taxes that come with it, the repairs and service and other purchases. And then we think having variable fees by county will be tough for the Department of Public Safety to administer. And this is really true for trucking companies as well, because you're sure they're doing this mixing, matching, where they put. And, of course, there will be extra time and money verifying they're being charged the right amounts in the right locations, and there's those expenses there. And lastly, these wheelage taxes would be instituted without a vote of the citizens, which addresses the accountability. Last piece here, street improvement districts. Again, you've also heard a lot on that. Again, as taxpayers, there's very little for us to like about street improvement districts. You know, how the fees will be determined is at the discretion of each city. They could be scalable, but in our mind that means they could scale the wrong way. And if you think about it, if you're assessed by traffic volume, what you're really doing is punishing economic activity. Secondly, they're totally unpredictable. They could vary among jurisdictions. Again, and our businesses move around. They will require new administrative systems to calculate, collect, cross-reference, and enforce failure to pay. So we've got to put that in so there's less going into infrastructure. And lastly, that they lack transparency. Given how they're enacted, they could fall outside of the current truth in lending taxing requirements, taking away that accountability, control, and incentives to keep rates fair. So you put it all together, We believe the fuel tax, the registration fees, the sales tax is a good system. We should build on that. We think we should focus on that, and they should be the basis going forward. We've paid our fair share in the past, and we're willing to pay our fair share in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions of the testifier? Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Houseladen?
Houseladen.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. My question is regarding the gas tax. Did I misunderstand? Do you support? Does the Trucking Association support the proposal in this bill, or just generically support a gas tax, but you're not willing to commit at this time whether this 5 cent is the appropriate amount?
Mr. Chair?
Testify.
Senator, as we know, transportation packages are, in essence, packages. So we support the concept of a fuel tax. And the less of the bad things that are in there, the stronger our support. And the more of the bad things that are in there, the less of our support. What I will say publicly is in 2008, we did support the last package that was passed, and it's very comparable to what's in here.
Any other questions for the testifiers? If none, thank you so much for your testimony, and we appreciate you being with us this afternoon. Amanda Doerr and Vic Moore. And once you're ready, please proceed.
Thank you very much. My name is Amanda Doerr, and I'm here today representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, which has membership of 86 cities throughout every corner of Minnesota. I'll keep my comments extremely brief because I know this isn't the committee's final budget proposal. However, what this bill does provide is an important starting point for the committee's budget discussions to move our state forward in terms of safety, mobility, and economic opportunity, a balanced package that addresses the infrastructure needs of both Greater Minnesota and the metropolitan area, both roads and transit, is necessary. The bill before you takes a statewide and system-wide approach to its transportation investment, and it's that sort of framework that should be considered as this committee moves forward with its budget recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that wonderful brief testimony. Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Vic Moore from the firm of Franzen & Moore, and today I'm here representing the Manheim Auto Auctions in the state of Minnesota, and I'll be very brief. I'm basically here just to express concern and ask for a clarification on the provision of the bill that expands the sales tax to automobile repairs. The auto auctions actually have an auto repair system within their auto auctions. They do wholesale transactions. When an automobile comes from a dealer to the auto auction, sometimes they'll buff it up, they'll paint it, remove the scratches and what have you. Then they just collect a commission on the auction of the vehicle. It's my assumption that the bill intends this to be for retail transactions and not wholesale transactions, so I'm just asking the Mr. Chairman that if this provision moves forward, that he consider some clarification on that language.
Also consider, Mr. Chair.
Yes, okay. Right. Senator Dibble?
That's all, yeah. Mr. Chairman. All right.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifiers?
Thank you.
If none, thank you. Any other testifiers, brief testifiers? If not, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't make any further speeches. I'm sorry. I can suspend.
Senator Dibble, we have Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Dibble, my question to you is in regards to the street improvement districts. Mm-hmm. And question from some folks is in regards to joint powers. There are cities that do have joint powers, and could you explain how this might affect any joint power?
All right. Senator Dibble, or are we going to have someone else?
So, Senator Kiffmeyer, I have no idea. Ms. Finn.
Ms. Fine, and Fine?
Finn. Finn.
And Finn. I said, and I should know that. Our sons go to school together.
Yes, they do, Mr. Finn. Chair. Ann Finn, representing the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'm not quite sure if I understand your question. What kind of joint powers are you referring to?
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Quinn. Any joint power? My question is fairly broad because I just know that sometimes you'll have a city, township, county, tribal, there are a whole variety of joint powers. And so sometimes in a city you have a joint power with frequently with a city. So most frequently, since it's with a city, and this is a municipal street improvement district, now municipals can sometimes be both city and township, or I just want to clarify. So I hope that's enough muddling to maybe you can help unwind it and just speak in general to any joint powers.
So, Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, if members want to look at the Municipal Street Improvement District language, it's on page 23 of the A1, section 5. And, you know, I'll take a stab at it, and maybe Ms. Berezovsky can help. But, you know, this is a fairly simply construed provision in authorizing municipalities to, enact this mechanism for street improvements. We do this in a number of arenas. We let cities, we authorize cities with an authority, a power to do something. I think to the extent that they're involved in joint powers agreements, those are construed for specific purposes. They get into a joint powers situation with another city or another level of government, a county or a township. I think this would operate separate and outside of that. I don't think this allows a joint powers entity to come together for the purpose of enacting a street improvement district. However, I will ask Ms. Berezovsky if I am accurate in my assessment.
Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, as I read the language, this authorizes a municipality, which is defined as a city, a home rule charter or statutory city, to take certain action. So I don't think it would affect any joint powers agreements or statutory powers, but it's restricted to a municipality in the language.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dibble, I think this is a real serious issue because you cannot have a city taxing a township. There are just a lot of issues there. I'm bringing it up for the purpose of, not that I have an expectation that you're going to clarify all of this or anything, but if I'm asking the question, and I just think there are things that this could be a problem. So I just want to mention it. And, Mr. Chairman, I know you have other work or efforts or you're taking input today, so I don't have any expectation of solution, but hopefully maybe just addressing the matter.
Mr. Chair. Ms. Finn. And Senator Kiffmeyer, I think the bill is pretty clear that the city can only collect fees from property owners within the city limits, and they can only use it on roads over which they are the road authority. So if it were a township situation, the township would be the road authority and not the municipality.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in many cases, again, that the whole point is that it's a joint power, so it isn't one of those situations where you have that. But, I'll leave it rest, and maybe I can talk some more with others because I'm not satisfied by this. And I think this is one of those things that can become bigger as we go forward, kind of the unintended situation, that's all. So,
Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm wondering if you have a specific instance in mind, something that you could help us to understand it.
I really mentioned it very specifically in regards to, for example, a city-township joint power. Sure. This is not a situation where you have, this is your county road or this is your city road, and I see Mr. Sulem is here. Maybe he'll, since he's a township association.
Please identify yourself and
Mr. Chair, members, again, Ken Sulem with the Township Association. Senator Kiffmeyer, I do appreciate your concern to watch out for it, but as I read this provision, we would not have any concerns with this ability. As Ms. Finn indicated and Ms. Berezovsky indicated, this is confined solely within the city. A joint powers agreement that we'd have for a different type of project or a service contract that we'd enter into township to city would be with the entity for a specific service. that is not defined or covered by the scope of this. So while we don't, as an association, take a stance as to how the cities want to finance their internal projects, that is all that section does is deal with internal city projects. It would not affect our ability to negotiate a joint powers or to work with an existing joint powers, nor does it grant the city any authority to come in and say, our new district is now going to encompass the township. It has to be confined to their municipal limits only.
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator Kickmeyer.
Thank you so much. And since we have some expertise here, so if you have a city and a piece of the city is a joint powers situation, does that mean then that this municipality taxing district can include all except the part that is with the joint powers?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, the joint powers is not in and of itself a government entity. The joint powers exist to perform a particular function. And so if you had a city that a portion of the city was subject to a joint powers for some particular purpose, that portion of the city is still city. It's not township. It's not encompassing the township. And so this provision would have no impact on that joint powers for whatever service delivery or whatever was being sought by the joint powers. So it would not have any correlation. They're two very independent entities in terms of the way the legal structure is set up.
Mr. Chairman, that's why I was asking the question. So I think that's sufficient for today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Dibble.
Oh, I was just going to thank Senator Kiffmeyer for raising the point. And should something, this provision or something like it, wind up in the bill that we consider next week, you know, we'll be sure to pay close attention if we're creating something that we don't intend to do. So we'll take a look at it.
Senator Senjum.
And Mr. Chair, this is somewhat related. It may be something everybody's aware of. It happened in my community last week, and has happened before, and it's within the law, but a major street situation, the south side of the streets in the city of Rochester, the north side of the streets in Cascade Township, major street improvement, the city council goes forward and exercises special assessments on that street. Those on the Rochester side of the street, that immediately becomes applicable. Those in the township side of the street, they're called deferred special assessments and will only be invoked when and if the annexation ever occurs on those properties. So there are deferred special assessments.
That's a thank
Senator
you,
Dibble.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. That's an interesting situation, and we should pay attention to it. I remember before cities really got their story straight between each other, there was a situation once where half of France Avenue on the Minneapolis side was improved and the St. Louis Park side was left undone. It was pretty funny looking. So thanks. Appreciate folks raising these points.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Dimble.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Mr. Chair. With that, I think it's all been said, and we're past our lunchtime. So I would move that we lay Senate File 891 as amended on the table. Well, I guess we don't need to move it. You can just lay it on the table.
Senate File 671 is laid on the table.
891.
I'm sorry, 891 is laid on the table.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, we are adjourned.